Good morning. Sorry, we're getting a little late start here, and I appreciate those who are here on time. We're going to get started this morning. It's been a while. It's nice to see everybody again. And, you know, what I'd like to do is call the tax committee to order, and I want to first introduce the new, what's the correct title? Committee Legislative Assistant to our committee, which is Sasha Bergman. So welcome her. You all remember Jamie. Welcome, Sasha. You all remember Jamie, and she had the nerve to go to law school, so we lost her. But we will miss her, and Sasha's doing a great job. So if you don't know Sasha yet, please get to know her, and she will help you with the needs that you have with this committee. So welcome, Sasha. I also just want to take a second to thank everybody who showed me their sympathies when my father died about 7 weeks ago. I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me. The larger legislative community that the public isn't always aware of, lobbyists and staff and legislators bipartisanly, I really appreciate all the sympathies and concern and prayers you shared with me and my family, and it really means a lot. I also want to just take a minute to hear from Representative Zila Forrest, who has had an exciting life since we last met, and I'm really sorry, Chris, and I hope you can tell us a little bit about your recovery. And for those who don't know what happened to Representative Zila Forrest, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been an interesting experience. Folks don't know, I got hit head-on going about 50 miles an hour back in July. I was involved in a pretty serious car accident and went through the experience of getting cut out with the jaws of life and sitting on a backboard for a couple of hours in the ambulance and trying to feel my toes and all that. It was an incredible experience, but I actually fared very well, and I simply suffered a separated shoulder that's coming along. As a matter of fact, Representative Marquardt has reminded me that it's an opportunity to improve my left side. And so coming back stronger than ever. So he's reminded me of that, and I've assured him that my left side is coming along nicely, but maybe in February all the bets will be off. But just a couple of other minor injuries, but certainly it does improve your outlook on life, and you value things a bit more that you didn't prior to an accident like that, because it was rather severe. And I feel rather lucky, especially since I have a constituent. I tell some folks, I have a constituent who was injured in a similar car accident a couple months before mine, and this person still is eating through a straw at this point. And so you discover that for some reason I walked away lucky. I figure now I can try to drive as recklessly as I can now because I've had my accident. Statistically, I won't get in trouble anymore. But thank you, Madam Chair, for asking. I'm coming along very nicely.
Thank you. And we're glad to hear that. And I know some folks weren't aware that Representative Zila Forrest would have this serious accident. We're glad he's doing well. To look at him, you'd never know. Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if he was a good attorney.
No, Madam Chair, I'm just fine. Although, if gas even goes to $8 a gallon, I'm still driving that SUV I've got now. My security blanket.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abney.
I'm just pleased that Representative Zila Forrest was able to see up close and personal the value of local government aid and its impact on our community.
Unfortunately, Representative Abney and Madam Chair, my community doesn't get any LGA. But that would have been time for the fire chief to ask. He was there. I'll tell him that was his opportunity while he had me there on my back. How about some LGA, or maybe the ambulance won't show up. I don't know. That was his opportunity to squeeze me.
Well, my sense is that this event in Representative Zila Forrest's life will return for further discussion in property taxes in the 2008 session as we talk about LGA again, but we're very glad you're okay. So thank you for that. And before we start with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, I just want to mention Commissioner Ines and I worked through this agenda along with Mr. Michael and Chair of Property Taxes, Representative Marquardt. And my intention really calling this meeting was, first of all, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has done their audit of the Department of Revenue, and it is this committee's job to have oversight. And so we'll hear from there, and we'll hear the Commissioner's response on that. We also want to get an update on the tax compliance initiatives that we have spent so much time working on in this committee. The one that was assigned last go-around is completed, and we'll get the final numbers on that, and then we're going to have the Commissioner tell us about where we're going with the last tax compliance initiative we passed that, as you all recall, we had a joint hearing with Representative Kahn's committee, And unlike the veto tax bills, the tax compliance initiative survived because they were carried through state gov finance. And so we're going to hear from Commissioner Inez on that. And then we'd like to get to the broader property tax discussion. I asked Mr. Michael to spearhead working with the Department of Revenue to tell us what we're looking at for 08. Given both that there wasn't a passage of a tax bill, we do have the preliminary levies set. We don't have the final levies, which don't happen until December 15th. But we now at least know the preliminary levies. We know what we're looking at for 08 in general. And then we're going to have information from the Department of Education on which school levies passed and didn't and what are the impacts for that. So those together to kind of give us an idea of what we're looking forward in for in 2008 for property tax increases. And then I wanted to add into the discussion, we have a panel of assessors who are going to share with us what's looking like is happening across the state as far as market values. And this committee knows, but often the public is not aware, that market values really are not tied to level of spending. And people often think that when the market values go up, it's just the assessor trying to get more money for the city council or the county government to spend, when in fact this committee knows that's not true. It is actually assessing the proportion or the slice of the pie that you're going to pay in your, into your local unit of government. I think we're going to experience a phenomenon where we have market values declining on residents and property taxes going up, and I think Minnesotans will be asking all of us what's going on, and I think it's an opportunity for all of us to try to help people understand the property tax system. So I thought if we could hear from the assessors just in general where they see market values going, I think it will be helpful for us going forward as we see property taxes go up in 08. So with that, if there's questions on what we're going to do today, otherwise we're going to go to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we're talking about events. We have a member of the Property Tax Committee, Representative Anderson, who has had an event in her life also over the interim, and she's sitting out there in the crowd.
Okay,
Yes, we do. Anyway, we'd like, I think there's an introduction to be made here.
Is that Representative Anderson, do you have your new family member with you? Oh, please. Yes. You should join us. Oh. And, oh, congratulations. And welcome. And, you know, I didn't see you there because the chair is blocking you and your beautiful new baby. And thank you so much for being here. And if you need a babysitter, right here. Love babies. So thank you for that. And thank you, Representative Marquardt. Okay, so we're off to the Office of the Legislative Auditor then. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Jim Noble is, you know, our lead legislative auditor, and he's off dealing with another committee meeting that's going out right now, but he did stop by early, and we're going to actually hear from David, is it Polisano?
Polisino,
who actually did the audit and is the person in charge of this particular audit for the Department of Revenue. And I believe we have the actual study right here in our packet, and if you can hit the highlights for us, we would appreciate it. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. And first of all, I didn't do the audit all by myself, and I brought a lot of people with me that did work on the audit. They're sitting behind me, and I'd like to introduce them to you first. Cecile Furkel, who is our new Deputy Legislative Auditor.
Welcome.
Susan Kalkemeyer, who is the auditor in charge, who supervised the work in the field. Okay. And then one of the two people that also worked on the audit is Jamie Madeira. She's also there.
Welcome.
And I'm here today to present the recent audit of the Department of Revenue. It was a selective scope audit, and by that, we audited only certain financial activities during the period of July 1, 2003 through December 31st of 2006. What we wanted to do was assess the department's internal control structure to determine whether or not there were any weaknesses that exposed them to an unsafe vulnerability. Also wanted to determine whether or not the department complied with legal compliance requirements. Some of the areas we looked at was employee payroll, travel, rent, repair costs. We also looked at the seized property process as well as tax abatements. As far as overall conclusions, we had 8 audit findings which dealt with internal control weaknesses and non-compliance with legal requirements. And I'm going to discuss 3 of those findings today. The first finding deals with that employees are not always accurately paid. And by that I mean an employee would get paid for 80 hours of work, But what we found is that they weren't necessarily being paid the way they were supposed to get paid. They were, it wasn't being paid for regular pay when they were actually, they were getting paid for holiday when they actually didn't work on holidays. We found that 29 employees received holiday pay without actually working the holiday. Their time was actually quoted for regular pay. In one instance, we found one employee had 58 hours of holiday pay in one pay period, and that was in a pay period that did not even have a holiday. And our real concern is that these holiday pay errors really mask a bigger problem, and that deals with the proper supervision and review of the timesheets. For them not to have caught a person with 58 hours of holiday, we were concerned that they weren't going to be able to detect errors when a person should have taken the 40 hours of vacation and it was mistakenly quoted to regular pay instead. Now, they're going to get paid the same, but the problem comes when they resign or retire, that time would then be paid back to them because their vacation would not have been appropriately reduced. And some of the main reasons for the error is that the state recently, about 3 or 4 years ago, changed their payroll system. And what it did, it shifted some of the controls away from the system itself back to the agencies. The other said in the past would have caught some of the errors were no longer present, and it forced the agencies to do a better job of reviewing and supervising the timesheets and also reviewing the output reports that would show what the employee was actually charged, what they got paid for in the payroll system. The second finding deals with the department inadequately safeguarding its fixed assets. And what we found there is that the department had not performed a complete physical inventory since 2005. And what we found is that there were, we found missing assets in the previous report. For the 3 years, they had 75 missing assets, including 24 different types of computing devices. In April of 2006, the department noted that they were missing 26 items. Half of those are computers. So what we're seeing is about, maybe every each year, about 10 to 12 computers are being lost or stolen and not being properly accounted for at the department. And as a result, they also did not submit the required lost or stolen asset reports. They did prepare them, but the reports sat with the agency and didn't get properly distributed to the proper parties, such as our office. And part of the concern with this finding is that it kind of leads us into probably a more bigger finding, and that deals with the adequate safeguarding of its non-public data, which is oftentimes stored on the computers. And we found that the department has not fully encrypted all of its computing devices. Recently, within the past year, the Office of Enterprise Technology, OET, has sent out directives to all state agencies requiring them to encrypt all of their computers. And as of May 2007, revenue, they have encrypted of, they have 800 computers that is known to the department. And the only way they know whether or not a computer has been properly encrypted is if the user logs on to the system so the software can detect whether or not encryption is present. At the time, they had approximately 500 users that were actively logged onto the system, and of those 500, 400 of them were properly encrypted, and they were working on encrypting the remaining 100. They went division by division. Our concern is the remaining 300 laptop computers that we really did not know the whereabouts of them, the status of the encryption, and what they were really being used for. And also, we found that as part of the directives, they also were supposed to be using these security cable locks, which would make theft a lot more difficult, and they were not using those. And we also found that in certain cases for ongoing tax audits and investigations, that employees were allowed to store non-public data on their computers for up to 30 days until they would get back to the office and then secure to the department's main computer system. So we think that right now there's a higher risk of non-public data being inappropriately dispersed because of the ability to store non-public data on the computers, not being physically safeguarded, and not having the proper encryption on all of the machines. And I would like to point out, though, that in no case did we ever find a single instance where there was any non-public data compromise. There were no breaches. This is more of a preventative measure to alert the agency that in order to ensure that they don't have some kind of a serious breach, that all these steps kind of need to be resolved. As far as how they responded, they took our findings very seriously and recommendations. They agreed with them, and also expressed a strong commitment to correct the fixed assets and non-public data, which seems to be the more crucial finding in this report. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Polisano, Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know what encrypted means. Does it mean they mark those computers somewhere so no one else can use them outside of the department or what?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Earhart. What encryption does, it takes data, and while it's on the computer through this encryption, it decodes it in a way that no one else can really look at. It kind of makes it unavailable for a person without having the other side of the code to be able to see what that data is.
And so, Madam Chair, they hadn't done that on whatever number of computers you're talking about?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about the missing computers and the non-public content that may be on those computers. And I'm trying to understand the standard under which the department would have to report under state law that there had been a breach of non-public data. As I recall, I believe it was last year, the department reported a breach when the United States Postal Service had, I think, mislaid a packet of 5,000, 50,000, I don't forget where the decimal point was, taxpayer returns coming from an office in northern Minnesota, and it was gone for 6 weeks. And so there was a situation where there was no evidence that a breach had occurred, but the department's interpretation of law was that they had to report that. And in the end, no breaches occurred. They found a dusty box in the back of some post office and turned it over. Here we've got what I see as a similar situation. We've got items including non-public data that are missing, and yet there hasn't been a report. And I'm looking for a consistent measure, a consistent standard against which they're interpreting the state law. Can you assist us with that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And actually, what the process is that when a computer is determined to be missing by the user, they do what they call a data spill. And what that is they contact the user, and they have the user tell them what was on the machine. So whatever would have been on that machine that would have or could have been compromised, they would then go further, like you said, and would then disclose it. So all the missing machines, so what we were told is that none of those machines had any non-public data on them, which did not require them to trigger a notification to any of the taxpayers. If they would have contained any non-public data, they would have then been required, and I think they're very well aware of that, and they would have notified the public taxpayers.
All right. That's the assurance I was looking for. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, I think we'll ask Commissioner Innes to join us at this time and respond to the audit of his department and share with us anything you'd like us to know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ward Innes, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And I just want to preface my comments regarding the audit. But just saying, I want to reiterate what they said. We take their findings extremely seriously. We had a senior management meeting immediately following the submission of their findings. We've communicated at the senior management level all the way down to the rank and file the importance of adhering and making collective action on each one of these findings. I'll address, for the most part, a couple of the findings you touched on. A couple of the findings regarding hours paid, making sure that our folks are more diligent in checking timesheets and that kind of thing. We've reiterated that. We've made it very clear that people need to be more vigilant and more diligent about checking timesheets. We're in the process of looking at a new process to make it a little bit easier for people to insert the information when they're filling out their timesheets. But as a general rule, we just need to do a better job at the supervisory level at reviewing those timesheets before they're submitted. And I think I put something in context, too. This was a 3.5-year audit where you found, 20-some individuals who had, put the information that wasn't entirely accurate. So in the context of a 1,300-person agency, the finding was a legitimate finding, certainly. But I think the general, we do a good job. We've communicated to management and to the individuals in the agency the importance of confirming, verifying, being very diligent in their timesheets.
Yes, Representative Colbert.
Not maybe to Mr. Ines, but maybe to Mr. Polisino. I thought you said in your testimony that the state had changed their computer system of reporting that. A couple of years ago, I mean, if someone misquoted something like that, that the computer or the system would have found it. Why did we, you know, why that change was made and put the responsibility back onto the each department? Because I can sure see mistakes being made on timesheets.
Mr. Palacino. Madam Chair, Representative, I guess that wasn't, I haven't really been involved in that. That was a decision that was made by, I believe, like the Department of Finance and the Department of Employee Relations when they upgraded what they called a semaphore. And for whatever reason, I think part of it, from my understanding, is that to bring that package in, if they did too much tinker with it, they would lose some of the warranties and the ability to have them stand behind the product. So they didn't really do a lot of tinkering to the product and rather left those controls to be borne by the state agency.
Okay. It would seem reasonable, though, that, I mean, the change is pretty easy to make a mistake. Sometimes there's coding.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, Madam Chair, another finding I'd like to touch on is inventory, making sure we have adequately secured our physical assets. The statewide policy is that you should conduct an inventory, a physical inventory, once a biennium, at minimum once a biennium. The Department of Revenue has adopted a higher standard than that. We have adopted an annual physical inventory standard. And in 2016, we reflected the follow that standard. And so we're in the process of completing our physical inventory. We'll have it completed by the end of the calendar year. And then on a going forward basis, we will be sure to do an annual physical inventory. But our standard is higher than the state's requirement. We think that's appropriate, and we're going to continue that. We will have the inventory completed by the end of the close of the year. And that inventory is important because that inventory will identify laptops that are available that aren't actively in use. Right now, we have encrypted, we believe, 100% of all the laptops that are actively in use. But as the auditor said, there may be laptops out there that have been stored in someone's office, have been, you know, basically retired, that haven't been plugged into the system in a while, and those may not be encrypted. This inventory will identify those, and we will move diligently either to encrypt them or to retire them and just, you know, get them retired. And so that should be done by the close of the calendar year.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yes, I'm asking a question about those lost computers. I think the overhead is 24 or 26, something like that. And then so they were either lost or stolen. Does each employee sign out the computer, and why would we not know whether they were simply lost as opposed to stolen? I mean, what is the check there? If it seemed that each employee was responsible for a computer, you would know that it was lost, or the car was broken into or something, adjudication.
Ms. Turner?
Either one of you, I had some of the departments to be able to answer that one.
Yes, I would think. Madam Chair, Representative, that's a very good question, and we've adopted a new stolen or lost property report. Actually, I want to be more diligent about reporting, but that's a great question. I'm not completely well versed on the protocol as far as each individual laptop. I don't have a laptop. I don't use one, so I have never gone through actually what the protocols are as far as issuing. The vast majority of these laptops, as you're probably aware, are in field audits, and so we are very vigilant about field auditors having their laptop. They obviously need it to do their business, and we have constantly reminding them of the importance of safeguarding that asset. One of the issues about purchasing these cable locks is there was some concern in the agency that having cable locks may, in fact, undermine security. Because right now, the basic protocol is you keep that laptop on your person at all times. So if you go to lunch and fill out it, you don't just lock it up to a table or a chair. You actually take it on your person. That's probably, in a lot of ways, maybe a more secure way of safeguarding that asset than cable locks. But the legislative auditor thought it was important to have cable locks. Also, the OEP policy, though it's not a bright line rule, has strongly encouraged cable locks, so we've purchased cable locks. Representative, I'd be more than happy to get back to you on the exact protocols of how these computers are issued to people, how they sign them out, you know, at what point do we determine when one is misplaced or stolen. I know our auditors safeguard those assets, and we'd be notified if one coming in the field out actually had their loss or compromised. But I will get back to you.
Clifton Carlson.
I asked that question. I'm a retired public employee teacher, and when I worked for the school district, if we find out equipment, it was numbered, and that number of that piece of equipment was literally after our name. You know, so if something would have happened, or if they were looking for that equipment, they would know where to go. And if they were to pose the question, what happened to it if it disappeared, then I would be able to answer the question, you know, in my room and stolen or...
Point well taken, Representative. Madam Chair, I think I can probably clarify the protocol. Right now, I got Bruce Fulton, who's in charge of all issues regarding data privacy.
I think that's a good idea. Welcome. And I missed your name. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce Scholl with Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome.
To answer your question, we have a lost and unaccounted for report, and that's what you're matching up with the physical inventory to identify that we hadn't identified exactly where these 24 devices are at. And that the physical inventory that we're conducting at this time is to verify that the information is accurate. And when an employee has a device, if they've lost that device or if it was stolen, they're advising us immediately. The question is that when they did the reconciliation between the physical inventory versus the number of devices that they were able to identify, that's where they came up with 24 unaccounted for. And that's the ones that... the reason why the physical inventory is so critical to be done on a very timely basis and on an annual basis, so we have a 100% accuracy as far as who those laptops or devices are assigned to, and that they are providing the timely notification if they are unavailable for whatever reason. We have no incidences that we were aware of where an employee had a device stolen and did not advise the Department of Revenue to take appropriate action.
Thank you for that. We appreciate that information. I do think probably what we want to do next year in the OA calendar is ask Mr. Innes maybe to get back to all of us on that when you've completed your work, because certainly I think this audit has raised a good issue, and we certainly, particularly when it's people's taxes, we really want to make sure we know where everything is. So we appreciate that information. I think Representative Carlson will help remind us of that, because I do think it's important that we follow up with these legislative audits. You know, the taxpayers pay for them, and it helps the departments do their best job possible. But I've noticed, and now being new as a chair to the committee, we hear these audits, but we don't often do them the follow-up to hear when a department says, we're going to go in and do these things. You know, did they do them, and what was the result? So maybe in 08 we could get a further chapter on this and a little more clarification. So thank you for that. Representative DeLaForest.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I did have a couple of questions, perhaps for Commissioner Innes or the other testifier, but I think Representative Carlson is right. I mean, when I worked for government once upon a time, it wasn't hard. When you got issued something, you signed for it. Mm-hmm. And we see this isn't the only department. It seems every committee we wrestle with this issue. We don't know what the inventory is. We don't know what we own. Something got stolen. We don't know who had it. I don't know what the issue is. It doesn't seem hard to me to issue somebody something and have them sign for it. It happens all the time in government. But in any case, that's my comment. The question I had is regarding the physical security, Commissioner Innes, and the potential or the vulnerability of data to theft, as Representative Dabney had talked about earlier. On page 12 of the report, it says that your department, at least at the time of the audit, did not know the encryption status of nearly 300 other computers in your inventory. What is the encryption status of those 300 now? Do you know what it is? Have you identified it?
We have. Madam Chair, Representative to the Forest, I've been told that 95% of our laptops are currently encrypted, and 100% of those are actively being used. By the end of the calendar year, as I said, we'll be identifying the remainder of those, and we'll make a decision whether they can be actively used, and we will move forward and encrypt them. If not, we will retire them and take them out of service.
Madam Chair, thanks. I just have one final question for Commissioner Innes. In the final paragraph on page 12, the sentence begins, the department then decides that the situation warrants notifying the taxpayer if there's some type of compromise of not public data. Can you delve into that a little bit more? I mean, is there a policy, a written policy? Does it have objective criteria as to when a taxpayer is informed when his or her data is compromised, or is it more of a situational decision that is made? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm gonna turn over to the chair.
Okay.
I understand it's a truthful analysis. He can deal with it. But there is a statutory requirement under certain conditions in order to notify taxpayer, they sent their information to compromise, then there may be another one. We have a different policy internally.
Okay. Thank you for rotating chairs. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative. Under the Data Practices Act, it has the requirement for the notification. At this point in time, it only applies to individuals. It doesn't apply to business heirs. Just to give you a little bit of a background, we'll have a sales tax auditor going out in the field to do an examination regarding a business entity. That auditor is going to have non-public information on their laptop, and they are authorized by state policy or by department policy to be able to keep that information on that portable device for up to 30 days after they've completed that examination, so they can conduct the audit. That order may be based in a field office. The field office is going to have a supply of backup laptops in case a technical feature comes up that they can immediately issue that temporary laptop to the auditor so they're not hampered as far as having appointments to do an audit and finding out that they can't conduct the audit because the technology doesn't make it, it's not viable. So they're able to get a temporary laptop to be able to do so. It's that surplus inventory of laptops, we didn't have the assurance that the encryption software is on those ones that were sitting in the cabinet collecting dust, waiting just in case an auditor's machine broke that they can immediately assign to it. As far as a notification requirement, as I said, we assess what kind of information was on the device that was lost. If it's an information that involves individuals, and we believe that there is a breach of that information, we're going to go through the notification process as we did when we had the lost backup tape that was lost in the mail for a period of time. In fact, we've even gone so far as not only limiting it to just individuals, but if we believe there's a reasonable breach of information affecting business information, we're going to invite that business as well, too, even though the statute doesn't require it. But we do have to go through an assessment of what data was on the device in order to make a determination if it applies if notification is required, and also assess the circumstances. Do we believe there's a reasonable expectation that the data has been compromised? One of the major protections that we have by encrypting the data, which gets back to your question about what is encrypted, so it scrambles it up so they can't understand or make any sense of it. Even if they did get the device, they can't get to the information itself. There is a recent advisory opinion for the Information Policy Analysis Division that says that agencies can consider the fact of whether or not the data was encrypted when they make a decision whether or not there's a reasonable expectation that data has been breached. That's the process that we go through with it. When is it a lost device? Work with the person who had the device, identify the data that was on it, the circumstances, was it encrypted, was it not encrypted, and then be able to make the determination, do we need to go take the next step to provide notification or not? So that, I hope that answers your question very
well. If I could ask just one more follow-up, Madam Chair, what would be the argument against just informing a business or a taxpayer, business entity or taxpayer, that the device had been stolen or compromised in some way in the first place? Is it a money issue? Is it a convenience issue? You know, why not tell Jim Dabney if a device with his personal data on it has gone missing, whether or not there's a reasonable expectation that the data may be compromised or whether the thief has a reasonable chance of mining the data? Why not just tell Representative Dabney, hey, a computer with your data on it's gone missing. We want you to know. Why not tell him?
Representative Manchin, yes, we have gone through that process, even if we do have the don't have any evidence that the data has been breached, but the usually in those instances, the auditor's working with that business at the point in time where they're conducting the audit. And they're communicating at that point, they may not be in a formal written letter of notification, but they're advising them in their one-on-one meetings with the taxpayer regarding those circumstances.
Hey, I'm sorry, I just have one more thought. Then let me pose a hypothetical then. I'm a little bit confused. I don't know if others are. Suppose that theoretically you've got a laptop and it's got, I don't know, 1,000. The non-public data of 1,000 individual taxpayers on it, but the department believes that there is no reasonable chance that the data would be compromised. The laptop's gone missing, but the encryption is such that perhaps you feel that there's virtually no chance of the data being used to compromise the taxpayer's identity or non-public data. Would you notify the 1,000 individual taxpayers under those circumstances, or would you not?
Madam Chair, Representative, in those instances that we believe that the data was encrypted and that the individual's private information is not in jeopardy as a result of the loss of the device, we would not take the initiative to notify all those 1,000 individuals on that specific laptop that would have been that the device itself was stolen or lost. However, those 1,000 individuals may all be employees of Company A. we will advise Company A in the process of doing the audit that that device was lost. Breaking it down to the individuals of all those employees of that company, if there's no reasonable expectation of the data has been breached, the question comes into, we want, when we give the notification out, we're giving specific guidance to the individual as far as what actions they should take to be able to protect themselves from the possible misuse of that information. When your person receives one of those notifications, they're, not necessarily thrilled to be receiving that notification, knowing the fact that they're going to have to take some significant actions of advising credit bureaus, monitoring their credit report, and looking for unusual activity. If there's not a reasonable expectation that they're at risk, we don't want to put them through that kind of a scenario where they're going to have to take a whole bunch of actions unnecessarily, because we don't believe that the information is at any jeopardy. I don't know if that's answered.
It does, Madam Chair. I'll let it go. I don't want to take all the committee's time, but it's important. It's an important issue from this respect. That really, I think, comes down to a public policy decision that may better be made by the elected officials as opposed to the agency, because I understand your argument, sir, but there's a counter argument. I had my data stolen at that veteran. The Department of Veterans Affairs had an employee who got his laptop stolen, and it was encrypted, but I got a letter from the Department of Veterans Affairs telling me about it, and I was happy to know, because first of all, you can't control the news cycle. The news came out, hey, 100,000 veterans have had their data stolen who served between these years. That's me. I wonder if my data was on that computer. It was nice to get a letter from the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs saying, yes, indeed, your data was on there, but we don't think it's been compromised because of the following encryption technologies that were used. It gave me peace of mind. It didn't put me through anything. I was more vigilant with my credit, et cetera, but I found peace of mind. So they say I wouldn't necessarily say that the department is wrong or I take issue with your viewpoint, but it may be a decision that is better left in the hands of perhaps policymakers as opposed to the executive branch. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
No, I appreciate that, Representative, of course. I think the key in listening to you question and your answers is what's reasonable. Is there a reasonable concern that something might, there might be an ability to gain access to it, and I don't know how that's determined. So I do appreciate the conversation because I think it's got us all thinking now. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I'll pass. I think Representative Dana Forrest and I were mining much of the same turf, and the department has answered the questions. I'm not necessarily convinced I'm comfortable with the answers, but they've answered the questions.
Thank you. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for showing up late, and if this has been covered, I can follow up with you or the department or the auditor after the hearing. But on page 12 of the report, and it's the sentence before, in the second bullet point there, the sentence before the one that Representative Dela Forest was referring to, it reads, when an employee reports a computer or flash drive as missing or stolen, the department requires the employee to list all of the data contained on the equipment. I guess my question for the individual from the auditor's office is, first of all, is that consistent with what other state agencies require when there is a stolen or missing flash drive or portable asset?
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not aware of what all the state agencies do for their policies, so we really didn't have the opportunity to go out and compare what Revenue does with other state agencies, so I'm not aware of how they would do it.
And Madam Chair, maybe for Mr. Scholl, am I pronouncing your name? Mr. Scholl, I guess what concerns me a bit about that, and it goes back, I think, to what Representative Carlson and Dela Forest were talking about to some extent. We're asking individuals, individual employees of the department, to recall what data they may have had on their laptop computer or placed onto the flash drive. Is there a system whereby the department, when it is allowing an individual to, I'll use the term, check out non-public data for one of these field audits, as you described, is that tracked in some way? Is that checked out so that when individuals' asset becomes missing or is stolen, they don't have to simply rely on, you know, well, okay, I remember I did this data poll for this time period. as opposed to you know, a broader time period or a larger group of individuals. That's what I'm concerned about, is that we're simply relying on an employee's memory, which may be faulty. Is there a mechanism whereby the department can go back and track what data, what non-public data, was pulled and placed onto this portable asset?
Mr. Shaw.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, we have an audit tracking system as far as the planning of audits, and so that we do give maintained records as far as which cases that auditor is working on. We also have a policy in place which says that they can only contain the information on a portable device for up to 30 days until the time after they've completed the examination. Now, the information that the auditor has is not from the generated from the department. It's not stored on those devices. What's been happening is that they're at the taxpayer's site acquiring additional information necessary to verify the correctness of their tax filings. That information, if they happen to be in a remote location, they can't immediately connect up to the department servers. They need to be able to store this information on the device. The flash drive is primarily being used as a backup functionality so that we don't have a situation where we have an auditor that's interacting with an entity, spending a substantial amount of time acquiring information, and having a technical issue, lose that information, and have to recreate the audit all over again. We need to be able to have a backup in that situation when they're out in the field. So when if a situation comes up where that the extra price has been lost, the auditor will be in a position to say, okay, I am working with these audits, and I know the information that was acquired on those audits and the practices that are being developed, so they can be able to provide a report of the NASA data that was on the device that was lost. I hope that answers your question, Mr. Cole.
I think it does, Madam Chair. I think what I'm hearing Mr. Scholl say, and again, I, like Representative Villafort, I'm not sure that it's right or wrong. I'm just trying to identify the issue. I think what I'm hearing the department say is that we are relying on an individual auditor's memory about the data he or she collected from the entity it's auditing. Maybe there's not another way to do it. Maybe there's not a better way to do it, but that does cause a concern that I have a hard time sometimes remembering what I did yesterday, let alone last week or 3 weeks ago, and what I may have asked an individual and what they may have told me. If an auditor maybe is assigned two or three audits at any one time, which it sounds like that can happen, you know, they're dealing with multiple entities, and you know, individuals' memories are not perfect, and that it's an issue with the concern. I'm not criticizing the department at this point for its policy, but I think there's an issue there that maybe ought to be looked at as to whether that really is the best way to do this, whether that really is the department the best policy for the department going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. And Representative Coles, and all of us, I know some of the members in this committee are really data privacy wonks and understand. I know Representative Dabney's worked in that area. There's a number of members in the legislature bipartisanly who really work on this stuff. I'm not one of them. But it seems to me this discussion makes me think we ought to get some of the tax minds and some of the data privacy minds together maybe to come up with legislation, because there seems to be some concern, and it isn't a criticism. The department is interpreting the current law the way the current law is written, I suppose. But just listening to you, Representative Coles, that gives me concern as well. So I don't know if this is something in the making, and we'll hear in 2008 more from Commissioner Innes on follow-through on all this, but I'm glad we're at least having this discussion today to go through this audit. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of curious about this policy about keeping the non-public data for only 30 days on a laptop. Is there some enforcement mechanism for that, or some mechanism to make sure that that actually happens, that at the end of 30 days that data gets erased or dumped?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chair, Representative
Liebling.
We do rely on the supervisor to provide that oversight. We do have the policy to give the security training to those employees as far as that expectation. As far as an ongoing audit program to make sure that they're in compliance in that area, we have not done that at this point in time. I also want to make mention of the fact that we've also implemented encryption technology on our flash drives as well, too, because we are very concerned about the data confidentiality, and we're taking all viable measures to make sure that, knowing the fact that we are going to have lost devices, it's going to happen, that we want to be prudent to make sure that the information on there is not easily accessible. But it's a The business functionality of an auditor doing field audits requires them to be able to store information on portable devices. We came up with the 30-day policy in this area saying that that's the only reasonable way that we can enable us to perform our business functionality and be able to do so so that the information is protected as well as backed up so that we get it, the audits done efficiently, and then once those audits are completed, to remove that information from the portable devices and store it on the department's secure servers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd just like to suggest then that maybe this would be an area for some kind of a spot check, or maybe even to the auditor. You know, it's just some sort of sample to see whether there's data older than 30 days that's left on these laptops.
Thank you for that. I think that's a good suggestion. And thank you for answering our questions, Mr. Scholl. Commissioner Ines, did you have more for us?
No, I don't think so.
Are we kind of through this?
You know, this whole area of data practices and data privacy is fluid. We're constantly revisiting our controls and protocols, so having a discussion like this is always has value. I know Bruce lives and breathes this stuff 24/7, and he's constantly coming back to our senior management team saying, you know, here's a gap we need to fill, and you know, and we take all corrective action within reason in order to secure taxpayers' data. And if you guys have any suggestions, we'd love to be part of any discussion about how we can improve in that area. If there's some concerns that have been vetted here. But we talk about this constantly at the Department of Revenue. And we whenever we think there's a gap in our security, we take corrective action in a very quick and diligent way. So we appreciate the feedback, and we'll be working with you guys closely to make sure we do all we can within reason to safeguard information.
Okay, thank you for that. And Mr. Palisano, did you or anyone else with the Office of the Legislative Auditor have any other information you'd like to share with us, or anything you would suggest that we do as follow-up for this discussion today?
Madam Chair and members, no. I think the report addressed some issues. I think the department is working very strongly on them.
Okay, great. Thank you. We appreciate you being here, and the rest of you from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, thank you for coming today. Appreciate that very much. So with that, I think we're going to then move on to the tax compliance initiative. Again, Commissioner, can you refresh my memory? Now, we passed last year in the state gov finance bill. We passed this new one you're going to tell us about, I guess, second. But before that, the previous compliance initiative, was that passed in the 05 session?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So, and members may recall that when we were discussing that compliance initiative last year, we knew there was a target that we wanted the department to get to, and they were kind of on their way, but that is now completed. So we're going to kind of hear, this goes back to this formula we talk about in tax compliance, where for every dollar we spend to close the gap, how much do you get? And it's kind of the low fruit first. You know, you can spend a little and get a lot, and as you keep going further into compliance, it costs more to get more. So this is where we can see kind of what was each dollar, what did we get in compliance.
Right.
Commissioner Ines.
Yeah, Madam Chair, member of the committee, I think in your packet is a handout that looks like this. It actually has a historical graph showing the previous compliance initiatives.
I think we need that passed out. Do we have that?
It was in the...
Oh, it is in there?
I think it would be very helpful if we had that to look at.
Blue? Tax compliance historical view? The blue bars.
That's
I think
it
it's coming
bars.
Around.
And basically, it just has a nice bar graph. It shows the four compliance initiatives. Including the one we're just beginning to undertake. But I can walk through the data while he hands that out. Essentially, the goal for the 06-07 compliance initiative, which we ended on July 1st of this year, was $90.6 million over the biennium. We ended up accepting $114.3 million, so we exceeded our target by about 26%. The ROI on that, the return on investment, was 6.4 to 1. So if you see once you get the historical document, you'll see that the ROI has fallen with each compliance initiative from a high watermark of 10 to 1 ROI to 6.4 for the one we just closed out at the end of last fiscal year. And we've just started ramping up on the new compliance initiative that the legislature tasked us with. As you see there, we've gotten about 8% of our goal towards that target. And that gives you an idea of where we've been. And I really applaud the agency for being so diligent and working so hard towards the 0607 compliance initiative that we did. I think we came in above what we expected on that. No question about it. But once again, I want to say not only has the ROI fallen over with each subsequent compliance initiative, the amount we've exceeded our target has also fallen. That first one, we were 162% of the target, and the last one was 126%. And as we testified in this committee on numerous occasions during the last legislative session, we believe that the compliance initiative you guys have given us is an ambitious one, and our people are very committed to making it happen. I think our attitude at the department is we're going to make it happen, but we're cautiously optimistic about reaching the goal. And to refresh your memory, it was you guys appropriated $20 million over the biennium to growth 100, net 80. I think that's correct. I'll just give you a little rundown to what some of the things we've done since legislative session recess regarding going towards compliance. We've hired 27 collection folks in the city of Ely. Those folks have been trained. They were hired in August. They've been trained. They will move into the new facility probably at the beginning of next week, beginning the end of next week. That'll bring our contingent in Ely to about 95 employees. Our second largest critical mass of revenue employees is in Ely. We've also hired an additional 44 individuals that will be office in Eagan, 31 of those in our sales tax division and 13 in the income tax division. They're all compliance-related hires. Start working. That office will probably be up and running early part of December. And these spaces always take a little more time to ramp up than a normal office space because we have, security measures that have to be taken, cameras installed, and those kind of things. So we think we're on target to meet this compliance initiative, but it will be a challenge.
I have a couple questions. One is on the hires. As I recall, when we had the joint hearing with the Representative Cons Committee, there was some concern about, and I think this spilled out of the last Department of Revenue compliance report, that attracting and retaining auditors was an issue because, in general, Minnesota doesn't pay its auditors enough. Or, I guess the story told was, it's a great place to start as an auditor and get some good training and then leave to the private sector and make a lot more. And, I don't know the truth of that within the world of human resources, but that was asserted a lot, I think, by lots of people. Was it difficult to hire these auditors and to get quality auditors, or did you find it was a difficult proposal to fill these spots?
No, the difficulty hasn't been in hiring the auditors. The difficulty has been in retaining the auditors over time. And that's been the primary issue. That issue has been somewhat mitigated by the fact that we've entered into this memorandum of understanding with both the unions and Doer. Doer and the unions were very helpful in extending that memo of understanding for an additional year. Especially in light of this compliance initiative, we've pushed hard to get an extension of that memorandum of understanding. Without that, I would have grave concerns about hanging on to these auditors beyond a year or two. With that, we seem to have a little more sticking power for keeping these auditors. But for the most, my understanding is that we haven't had a large difficulty getting auditors in the door. And money needs pretty extensive training. And we're a great training ground for these auditors. It's year two. Right when they become productive auditors and really are bringing in the high ROI, is that they get recruited away by CPA firms. So I'll keep you posted, though. This is a big issue for us, and I'll keep you posted on how we're progressing in that area. But the memorandum of understanding was absolutely essential to us meeting this compliance initiative. And thanks to the unions that were great, and so was Nick with Doer, of extending that an additional year.
Okay, and thank you for that, Commissioner. One other question I have, and I know this is really difficult to talk about because we all have to take positions often the state agencies or the legislature or whoever takes a position a little more extreme than where they expect they're going to end up. And often these compliance debates between the legislature and the Department of Revenue, and this is under either party being in charge, I've watched it both ways, there's the perception, I think, and I don't know if it's real, that, the department comes in and says, with that much money, we could never get that much money in compliance. I mean, we can't get that. And so here's our goal. So we want the goal here. And then, of course, the compliance initiative comes back. And, of course, the department actually took in more money than they said they could. And it's sort of like, good job, double bonus here because you said you'd get this, but you actually got more. And it sort of fuels this cycle of expectation that, whenever there's money given to the department to find compliance, they actually always surpass the goal. And while it is ticking downward, we can see that. how do we get to knowing what that really is? Because last year, as you recall, in the looking for money, bipartisanly, people were trying to say, you know, we'll just give you oodles of money and you'll close the tax gap. I mean, you'll get a billion, which, of course, you know, we would live in a police state to get a billion. But, you know, how can we as legislators and your department have a better understanding and build better trust in these go-around when we see, you know, there is a goal set and the goal is surpassed, which is great. I don't want to be complaining about that, but it's hard to know. Why aren't we more accurate at trying to figure out what we can really obtain when the department is given money to get compliance?
Madam Chair, good question. And these compliance initiatives are as much about predicting what you can bring in based on the appropriations the legislature gives you. It's as much an art as a science. Because there's not the simple factors about, well, your ROI and 0405 or 7.5:1, you know, you can do 6:1 now. There are other logistical issues that come into play too. Now, for example, we're at maximum capacity now at our current building, the Fasten building. And that's partially a function of OAH now is housed there. They have 60 employees. So we've been scrambling around trying to find appropriate space for the employees. So there's logistical issues like that. There's also just a simple idea about it. Now, this compliance issue will result in probably 120 new employees as part of revenue. That's a 10% increase in our allotment. And that doesn't take into account normal attrition. We're adding new people. And so we also have a concern beyond meeting the compliance initiative about what is healthy for the department. At what rate can you grow the department every 2 years and maintain professionalism that we've come to expect from the department, the taxpayer treatment we've come to expect from the department? I mean, a number of years ago, before the compliance initiative came into being, it was about a 50-50 split between compliance resources, FTEs for compliance, and then support of the compliance. And now we're at about 65-35 compliance versus dollars. So the whole agency has shifted into a kind of a hyper compliance mode, which is I'm not just saying that's inappropriate, that's not the right balance, but I think that it becomes a tipping point where other functions that the department is tasked with doing have the potential to be undermined by putting so much emphasis on compliance and so much emphasis on bringing in revenue in a 2-year time frame. You know, we constantly preach to everybody in the department the importance of maintaining the level of professionalism, which I believe we have, the etiquette towards taxpayers. I mean, there's always that concern that there's this sense of urgency to meet the compliance issue of, well, I mean, we don't treat taxpayers in a professional manner. We have maintained that standard, but I think there's always those pressures that we got to constantly make sure we recalibrate and make sure, okay, everybody's, you know, doing the right thing. So, you know, it's part of it. Part of it is that we see the declining ROI. We see the pressure that our people are under to meet this thing. And others are just things about growing an agency in that kind of way, just adding so many new employees. You know, we take our most experienced and most productive auditors to train our new folks. So they're out in the ranks, and it's just hard to constantly be in this compliance mode where you're upgrading constantly, putting more resources into it. I am optimistic, gosh, that we're going to make this goal. Our people are committed to it. We all fall hard because we're going to get it done. We're going to do it, but it's challenging. It's challenging to add 10% every 2 years, new employees, and to keep those people, and keep a good environment. So there's other challenges beyond just throwing pen to paper and doing calculations. Oh, we can do 6:1. Madam Chair. You know, there's more of other more nebulous calculations that impact the agency.
Okay, thank you. Representative Demmer, then Earhart, then Wolfmeyer. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Commissioner, you touched on probably a symptom of what I want to ask about, and I have a concern about the reason for noncompliance by the people out in the private sector. As a business person, former business person, whatever, I get concerned about why people aren't complying. You know, there's just the plain willful, I see if I can get by with it, which is the worst, obviously, and then there's cash flow issues. Business is not doing well. They don't have the money to submit their sales tax revenues or whatever, or pay their income taxes. And then there's the issue of we didn't know we weren't complying because the rules are kind of, as I've introduced legislation regarding sales tax, for example, and what's subject to and what isn't. Does the department track reasons for noncompliance in those kinds of things so that, with the idea that maybe we can take a step back and say, as public policymakers, do we have rules? Going back to, Madam Chair, what we had at the very beginning of session last year, when Mr. Michael came out and said, here's what tax policy should be, and one of them was simple, and people can understand and know how to comply. I think sometimes we need to step back and say, are we doing that? Commissioner, do we have any way to gauge that, to see how we're doing? Because I, too, have a concern that we're becoming Gestapo, if you will. We're out there hammering on people, and there's a, I think there's a general sense when people find out somebody didn't have to send in extra tax, whatever, that they were crooks or something like that. Can you help me with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, it's a great question. And, you know, the gap analysis study that we've done in the past, due to slice and dice, there's a causes for the gap, but, it's, you know, we just slice and dice a non-filer about X percent of the gap, and underreported are another part of the gap. And but we don't, we've not done able to really measure how much of it is involuntary non-compliance that's the result of just not understanding the rules of the tax code and what their responsibilities are. I would reckon that a large part of that gap is attributable to that. And you look at the youth tax. We've had this discussion in this committee at numerous times. How many people on the street that stop them understand that they have their obligations under the youth tax? Few and far between us. And so I think there's a sizable part of the population that is inadvertently, innocently non-compliant with the tax. So it's really our responsibility and this committee's responsibility to do everything they possibly can to make the system mitigate complexity in the system. And our people constantly see out in the field that the biggest underminer of voluntary compliance, it undermines compliance across the board. And so that's why federal conformity is such an important thing to pursue. It takes a lot of complexity out of the system. That's why we need to do a better job maybe of issuing revenue notices that are clear and understandable, not just by the practitioners, but by the guy in the street who needs to read a revenue notice. So, you know, we constantly look at clarifying things, taking complexity out. Every year our department bill, to a large extent, involves that. Ambiguities and facts that need to be clarified. You know. But it's a constant struggle, and our people are very concerned about the lack of federal conformity. We've looked at our draft of the MNN, you know, form, whatever, it's a mess. And it's the kind of form you put it in front of an individual, and they're going to probably do their level-headed best to comply with the reality of the complex. And so it's a struggle. It's a struggle. I think our promotion of e-filing and some of those things has helped. And I want to announce today that we have surpassed Iowa's number one e-filing state in the country. Last year they bested us by a few tenths of a percent. But we do see that for those folks who e-file, there's a much lower error rate and those kind of things. But it's a constant struggle. And to your point, Representative Demmer, we don't have a really good way of measuring how much of the gap is attributable to just sheer complexity.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this regional in nature? You said we've got the Ely office. Does that mean that we found some folks up there that weren't being audited and now we should put one over in Lanning's area or what?
Madam Chair, Earhart. No, there's no correlation between where we locate our folks in Ely and where they're conducting their audits. Actually, the Ely facility is a collection. It's a flat-out collection division. So they pursue tax debt and non-tax debt from the main agency. So they're making calls all over the state, all over the country to collect.
Representative Earhart, did you want more auditors in Edina?
Well, I was wondering about that. I thought you'd move to that before long here if that were the case. On the cost of compliance, did you say how much it costs you to collect that $110 million? It doesn't cost $112 million.
No, it's actually our goal. Sorry, trying to see here.
It's the CROI. Yeah.
It's on look on the left here. I'll give you an indication. This little box.
Yeah. So for example, the initiative we just got passed with, the legislature appropriated us $20 million. And with that $20 million, we need to generate $100.
So
the net gain is $80 million to the state general fund. Mm. That kind of gives you, that's a 5-to-1 return.
Okay.
You get a little better than that. Yep.
This is a cumulative, so we can't say that in the last 2 years you've added $300 million to our coffers, roughly, and now we're going to expect $300 plus another $100 million.
I'm no forecasting expert. I don't know how finance does it, but I do believe that the previous compliance initiatives are built into the base of the forecast.
Yeah.
So they assume that we're going to be collecting that you know, that's $114 million on a going forward basis for every year. So, I believe it is built into the forecast. So that's an expectation that's built into the forecast.
Thank you for that. Representative Wolfhunter.
So, Chair, members, Commissioner, I'm always looking for numbers, so I just met with some group homes in my district, and they're dealing with about a 35% turnover because they don't, you know, we don't pay our healthcare workers enough. So, I mean, I just throw that out to you. When you talk about turnover and the difficulties, you may not get a sympathetic ear from all of us because, I mean, we're dealing with a lot of industries that have a high turnover. So that's one point. And then the other point is just, I am interested in hearing what efficiencies can be achieved through technology. And I don't know. I mean, just things as simple as recording your time. I mean, the company I work for has got such a sophisticated system that if I put in the wrong code, it somehow knows to tell me that was the wrong code and sends a note to my technical director saying, you know, she did it wrong. So, I mean, there's a lot of systems out there. So, you know, that's the other part I'm always looking for is I just hope, you know, you got a department that you also ask for the dollars to improve, you know, technology so that you can achieve some of this without having this hyper-vigilance of checking things out with people because computers do it better. So.
Thank you for that. And Commissioner Ines just loved that. I could just tell because he really asked for the dollars for technology last year.
Adam Chair and Vice Chair, point very well taken. In fact, legislature treated us pretty well last year. We asked for $16 million for integrated tax system, which really is, if we could do one thing to improve efficiencies at the Department of Revenue, it would be to implement an integrated tax system. And the legislature came forward and gave us 12 of our $16 million. We've identified additional resources within the department. Instead of improving antiquated systems with no increase in functionality, we're going to take those resources and use them for the integrated tax system. I think by the end of this month, we'll have chosen a vendor for the integrated tax, and we'll start implementing it next year. But that really will change dramatically how we do business. We'll have better information to share with taxpayers. It will give the taxpayers will make one phone call and determine their tax liabilities across all tax types. It is the future. You guys, thank you, Madam Chair, for your support. I know you were very instrumental in securing those dollars. But we will be back this year asking for the additional $4 million.
Of course you will.
But it really is, to your point, Vice Chair, it is the future for the Department of Revenue. And we're a little, unfortunately, about 20 states have already signed down the integrated tax, but we're a little bit behind the curve, which is not a place we're used to being. The Department of Revenue, I think, has a history of being ahead of the curve when it comes to technology and implementation and stuff. So you guys were great last year. We really appreciated your support, and the integrated tax has changed a lot of the time.
Thank you. Representative Wheatley. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to get back to something that Representative Demmer was talking about, the complexity issue, and I just want to comment more to him rather than to you, Commissioner, but, you know, this complexity issue, I think most of us like to operate on the assumption that most people are honest, that most people want to do the right thing, and that if we make it easy for them to do that, and, you know, this complexity issue is something I've been concerned about in my 1 year on this committee. I mean, I've really gotten a little bit of my PhD I'm expecting to get someday here. But, you know, this I've learned a lot about how complex our tax system is. And But I just want to point out to Representative Demmer and to others that we have that same issue in other areas of our state budget, and the one that I'm thinking of in particular is our public health care program. And I just want to suggest that we should extend the same kind of assumption or presumption that people are want to be honest to people who are attempting to use our public programs as well, because there is incredible complexity in those programs, and we know that there is a little bit of, you know, always people who are on programs who shouldn't be and that kind of thing, and where we tend to demonize those people, whereas we don't want to demonize our taxpayers. And I just want to say that I think that human nature extends equally in both areas, and that we should be very careful about how we talk about people who are not complying and, you know, presume in the first instance that they would comply if they were given the right opportunity. Thanks for that. I mean, I guess you don't want to respond to that.
Well,
only thing I'll say that
was Representative is that due to the very persuasive case you made, we brought back the toll-free numbers. So we, and I think that was an important step. There are people who want to talk to a live person, ask a question. We should be able to provide that service. We're doing that. And also because of this, kind of the feedback we got from this committee, we have, you'll see when you get their tax instructions this year, that we prominently flagged the PPR on there. On the front of the instructions, I don't know if it says look at the back, and it gives you the parameters for eligibility, what the average check was, just to kind of give a little more prominence to the PPR and educate taxpayers about not only what their liabilities are, but what maybe potentially what they're entitled to under refund service.
Thank you. And I should say, just coincidentally, I've just received a memo from Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael, and I have not read it yet, that I requested about compliance, not exactly compliance, but marginal tax rates and how people are impacted in this is kind of a marriage of the two items Representative Demmer and Representative Liebling are bringing up, and that is the programs that we have, like the Working Family Tax Credit, and why do people comply or not know they can use it, and why do they drop off if they start working, and how much are they losing? What's the disincentive to work? And that is an issue for this committee as well that we hope to spend some time on next year. So we're gonna get those health programs and money that's available to citizens of low means and tax issues wed if we begin to look at those things together. And I'm just starting working on that. So we'll probably have some more discussion next year on that. But Representative Demmer, you wanted to respond.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I feel a need to. First of all, this is not the Health Care Committee. This is the Tax Committee, and your point is well taken, Representative Liebling and other members, too. I think we can take that to heart. But keep in mind that one of the things we're talking about here is not services provided to the public that they are coming to sign up for, and which we're trying to make them simple so they can sign up and take advantage of programs. We're talking here about compliance with things that are imposed upon businesses and individuals, and primarily I'm thinking businesses, imposed upon them by this legislature and by this state government. And we're imposing upon businesses to collect sales tax that's very complex. When do you collect it? When don't you? We tell them they have to do that. And then we're going out and we're saying, now where's our money? We're going to check you to make sure you're giving us all of our money. That's a far different thing than providing programs for people to come in and sign up to get assistance. I think they're similar. We have to be. I understand the need to remain simple, to make things as accessible as possible to people. But I think we're talking apples and oranges with the case that I was making, and that it may be true with income taxes also, in a little different case. But I'm thinking in terms of businesses where we impose upon them an obligation and a duty to collect on the part of the state of Minnesota, where sometimes our rules are so complex that they're trying to do it and don't know if they are or not. As a small business person, we may sit in this committee and learn about these things. I experienced it for 25 years trying to do it. And that's a far different thing and a far different lesson than sitting here and academically thinking through how it should work. When you're sitting at a desk by yourself and you're a small business person, you don't have staff people to try to read through all the tax codes. In the meantime, you're trying to sell something to three more customers to make a living. Believe me, this is a huge issue. And keep in mind that the vast majority of employers in our state are small business people that do not have the staff and expertise to wander through these things. So I understand the complexities. I understand the need to be simple in all areas of state government. But again, this is not the Health Committee. This is the Tax Committee. And I'm talking specifically about issues of compliance where we impose upon people the obligation to do things for us as a state government. And then we go out and have various reasons for pounding them on the head about it.
Thank you for that. Representative Liebling? No? Yes? I thought I saw your hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I see I kind of struck a nerve with Representative Demmer. And Representative Demmer, I also have hired people and run a small business, perhaps not as long as you, but I mean, I do take these issues very seriously, but I do have, and I understand the distinction you're drawing, but I guess this is just an example of how we maybe see things a little differently, because to me, when somebody's needs health care for themselves or their children, that to me is every bit as important as when we deal with their money. So I just want to make that point.
Okay. Mr. Reines, you don't have to get in on this. I think we are done with compliance, and we're going to get to property taxes, which I think we're really interested in knowing about. So I thank you all for all of that, and I think we're going to hear from, not sure, Mr. Folkman and Mr. Ouellette are coming forward. And Mr. Fulton, can you direct us to which handouts we should be looking at? I do not think we have them. So if you could tell Mr. Cummings what are you having us look at? That one? Okay. So, and just to recap before we start here, members, I asked Mr. Michael to work with the department to generate whatever information the department thought would be helpful to all of us to understand kind of what 2008 might be looking at. I have not seen any of it, and I have not been a part of creating it. I wanted it to be a strictly, you know, nonpartisan attempt here to just show us what they know. We're looking at for Pay 08, given that we've got the preliminary levy set. And I don't even know how the data is going to be presented here. So I just appreciate that you've brought it forward for us, and we'll probably have a lot of questions here. So direct us to where you'd like us to start, Mr. Fulton.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Gordon Fulton with the Property Tax Division. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And working with Mr. Michaels, what we are trying to present here today is two things. Try and give you a general overview of the proposed levies that are going to be in place for 2008, and then also give you a general overview of some of the market value trends that we're also seeing out there throughout the state. And to supplement the discussion on the trends, market value trends, we also have four assessors here to also comment about some of the more specific issues that are more closer to on the ground, as I like to put it.
Okay, excuse me, I apologize. Does everyone have it yet, what we're going to look at here? I just want to make sure before we walk through it. Everybody has this? Okay.
And what I'm going to do is sort of set the table for how we're trying to roll out the information today for you.
Okay.
The first discussion that we're going to have is by Eric Ouellette. And I first want to like to announce to the committee that Eric has just recently joined the Property Tax Division as our Property Tax Research Director. He comes from the League of Minnesota Cities, and we are very fortunate to have his experience and knowledge of the system to help us provide analytical information and other kinds of reports back to the committees as they request it, and also assist us in some of our oversight responsibilities. So Eric is a new person to the Property Tax Division, but a very well experienced and knowledgeable person of the property tax system, which there aren't too many people out there who can really fully grasp the total system. But Eric will present an overview of the proposed levy for cities, counties, towns, and special districts. It's a fairly high-level presentation for today. We have provided individual city and county information to House staff last night, and it is public information. Usually in the past, what we have done, we've tried to provide a release of this information about mid-November. We would do so after we've been able to synchronize put information together for the Department of Education on the levies that were just voted on this week, and we do some quality checks of the information, and we're able to put it through our property tax model to generate some of the impacts that the proposed levies might have on the property taxpayer. That's coming a little bit too quick for us to do this time around. So what we're doing here is just giving you pretty much the proposed levies as reported to us from the local jurisdiction. And also to supplement our presentation, we've asked Tom Melcher from the Department of Education to come before the committee to give you a summary of the recent referendums that were voted on this last Tuesday. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric to give an overview of the city, county, town levy increases, and then we'll have Tom Melcher come on board, and then Eric will give a quick overview of market value trends before we turn it over to the assessor.
Okay, and if I may, before you start, Mr. Ouellette, and welcome, my preference would be, rather, unless it's just clarifying information, rather than any of us asking questions during the presentation, I think we should get through it. And the reason is, we all tend to do this. We look at what happened in Greater, because we're a Greater Minnesota, what happened in the Metro, or what's happening with the city councils, or which levy is passed, and all this kind of stuff. And I think it's better to get the big picture state, you know, hear the county, hear the city, hear the school districts, the comments on what percentage of the school levies passed, and then, very importantly, what's happening with market values. I just flipped through myself and saw myself doing this as I looked at how market values are plummeting for certain properties. And so I think if we can get through it all and then just have a broad discussion with everyone on all of it, I think that'd be helpful. Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellet with the Department of Revenue. We just received the school referendum results, the preliminary data on the results from the Department of Education yesterday. So the handout does try to reflect those referendum results, but it's not perfect. We've already gotten a correction subsequent to printing this. So this handout's already dated, but it's pretty close. Mr. Meltzer will be able to go into much greater detail about the education levies. I'll just hit the highlights of the statewide trends, and then we can get into more detail as you're interested. The preliminary levies in total statewide are projected to increase about 8.1%, and that does include the state general education levy, or the state property tax levy. If you were to exclude that, the local property taxes, the proposed increase is about 8.35%. Now, last year, the final levy increases were 7.9%, and generally there's about a $20 to $30 million reduction from preliminary levies to final levies. So we're on track to be somewhere right around where we were last year in total for statewide levies. On the first sheet, we have some trend line information. The last 3 years, the average final increase was about 7.7%. So again, we're looking at something right around there or a little bit higher, depending on how much levies come down when the final levies are certified in December. I apologize, I'm recovering from a cold, so my voice might go in and out. Now, you'll notice there are two 10-year averages listed on the handout, and that's because of the significant anomaly of the big plan between 2001 and 2002 really throws off the 10-year averages for change. So we show the 10-year average change both including that year and then excluding it. So if you don't take into account the big changes from the big plan, the 10-year average increases is about 5.6% those other 9 years. But if you include the big plan, it's about 4.3% because there were such significant reductions in 2002. Further down the page, we break it down by jurisdiction. The percent increase is the first column. Counties, 7.2%. Cities, 9.2%. Towns, 7.2%. Schools, 8.7% for a total of 8.1%. And then the three following pages get into a little bit more detail on cities, counties, and schools. I'll go over the city and county pages, and then we'll turn over to Mr. Meltzer to talk about the school levies. On the second page, the city's proposed levy increase is 9.2%. Last year, their proposed increase was 9.0%. Final was 8.3%. So just a couple tenths of a percent higher than last year's numbers. The three-year average final for cities was 8.1%. A little further down the page, you will see that Metro Greater Minnesota split where the proposed increases are about 3.5% higher than the Metro cities. And then at the bottom of the page is a distribution of the frequencies to show you how many cities had significantly high proposed increases. 122 cities, that's about 14% of the cities in the state, their proposed levy is 20% or higher, and that's about evenly split evenly distributed among large cities and small cities. We did also list specifically the three largest cities in the metro area and the three largest in Greater Minnesota, just for illustration purposes. And I just want to point out the St. Cloud number because that will jump out at you. There's a 31% increase. Yeah. They had a very large voter-approved levy last year for some public safety investments, and that is a big part of that number. So before you get... There's a story to be told with that 31% that I'm not fully qualified to make, but there's a lot going on in St. Cloud that was voter-approved that goes into that 31%. The counties on page 3, the proposed county increase is 7.2%. That's pretty consistent again with what was last year. Last year the proposed increases were 7%, final was 6.9%. So again, pretty consistent with last year. 3-year average 6.4%, so a little bit higher than a few years ago. Like with the cities, the Greater Minnesota counties do have a slightly higher increase in levies than the metro. The Greater Minnesota counties have a slightly higher increase than the metro counties, about 1.3% increase. And then again, there's the frequency distribution further down on the page that shows only two counties with increases higher than 20%. One thing that I skipped over on the city page, and it's also on the county page, is looking at the combined property taxes and state aids to see how that changes the increase. The local government aid program did not increase for 2008. So if you take into account the combined levy plus aid for cities, it's a 7% increase rather than the 9.2% levy increase. For the counties, their combined levy and aid increase is 6.6% as compared to their just levy increase, which is 7.2%. So again, depending on whether you want to look at revenue base or levy only, the revenue base increases are slightly smaller in terms of percentage. Do we want to ask questions now? Or
do you want to have some questions on those before we turn over to Tom?
I think
Tom,
we should just go through it all, and then I'm sure we're all interested in different pieces, so we'll ask you to all sit at the table when we're done. So, Mr. Meltzer, and I should mention, Commissioner Innes and I and Mr. Michael, we had a discussion about these school levies. I had originally planned to have this tax committee meeting in late October, and you probably saw it show up and get canceled, and that was because Commissioner Innes and I both agreed that even having this hearing pre-people voting on their school levies may one way or another influence something if we knew the data. So we thought, well, let the elections take place before we hear the report, and that way we'll know which percentage of school levies passed. And I could see a scenario in my mind that it would become public that, and I didn't know what the number would be, if it was 7%, 8%, 9%. Property tax increase across the state would come out right as voters were going to the polls. And I just made the decision, I thought it would be unfair for anything the committee's doing while it's not in session to influence that one way or another. So Commissioner Innes and I both agree that we thought it would be better to get these numbers after the election had taken place. It would just look a little suspect. Why would a tax committee be having a hearing a week before an election? And I don't think anybody on either side of the issue or either side of the aisle or the department wanted to be involved in those local decisions. So thankfully, we do have some information now that we're going to hear from Mr. Meltzer about what actually took place with school levies around the state. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Meltzer, and I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education. And I do have a separate handout with the department.
Okay. We have
logo on.
Oh yes, does everyone have this one? Department of Education. Thank you.
I was advised that you were looking for maybe a very brief overview of the overall school levy situation as well as the referendums, and that's what the first couple of pages inside the cover sheet do. The first page here, the top two thirds of this, is showing where we're at currently on the truth and taxation notices. Essentially, right now the net bottom line on the truth and taxation notices is that there's only about a $10 million change between pay 07 and pay 08 levies, because they of course do not reflect the results of the referendum levies that have occurred. And we did have a number of phase outs of existing referendums to the tune of about $75 million that offset some of the other growth. The lower portion of the page shows what we're projecting to be added by the time we have the final levies, which is about $152 million in additional levies because of the results of the election earlier this week, as well as about $6 million in new bonding, debt service levies as a result of new bonding, and a small adjustment in alternative teacher compensation levy. So my numbers are slightly different than the ones that you have on the last page of the Revenue Department information. I'm projecting about a 9.1% increase in the school levy over pay 07, slightly higher than the 8.7% that the Revenue Department is showing, primarily because I've added in some debt service levies that are being added between now and the end of the year as well. The very far right-hand column of this is showing the breakdown between net tax capacity levies and referendum market value levies. Of the total increase of about $168 million, about $68 million will be in net tax capacity levies, and $99 million, or roughly $100 million, will be in referendum market value levies. That's primarily the net of the $152 million in new referendum elections minus the $75 million in the expirations. And we've also had about $22 million in shifting between state share and local share of existing referendum levies because of growth in tax base, which reduces the state equalization aid share. If you turn to the next page, I was also advised there might be some interest in comparison with end of session. figures, and what this shows basically is our current projections of school levies for PO8 are coming in about $39 million under what we projected at end of session. About $14 million of that is in referendum levies. Of course, when we project the referendum levies at the end of session, it's before we even know what will be on the ballot. So we think we came actually pretty close to what the projection was. We're also down about $11 million in debt service levies, and we found that school districts had a little more surplus fund balance in their debt service accounts. We have about a $10 million additional reduction in school levies for debt excess than we had projected. So overall, about $39 million lower than we projected in end of session for school levies for PO8, and that includes about $28 million in net tax capacity levies and about $12 million in referendum market value levies.
And I apologize for interrupting, but I just want to clarify something for committee members. I think that request on where we were at end of session was something I had requested, and that for members' benefit was, people ask often in tax committee, when we do these forecasts, how do you know what percentage of levies are going to pass, you know? And the departments do have to take a guess. You know, 40% of them will pass, 70, 80. And so your number that you were referencing there was, you're showing us where the departments sort of guessed how many of these school levies will pass and what really happened. So you were, is this correct, that the difference is about $14 million? Am I looking at
about,
the right
number? We were guessing about $14 million higher in terms of referendum than actually passed.
Okay.
And I would also add that at the time of the end of the session, we didn't even know what would be on the ballot. So we had first had to guess who was going to ask for one, and secondly, how many would pass.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think that's just instructive. But I really appreciate that, because I think it's really instructive for members to see how dynamic and complicated it is for the departments to even try to make these projections. I mean, to have to guess, will certain cities even go out, or school districts, and what percent will pass? So these are never right on, but that's pretty close.
We thought so. Yes.
Thank you.
To turn to page 3, now we're going to get into the details of what happened with the elections, the operating referendum elections this past week. And we had school districts, by the way, go out to the voters for a dollar amount per student. So they're asking to approve a revenue amount, which is going to be partly state aid and partly property tax levy. So looking at it from that perspective, we had $167 million out of a requested $249 million approved, which was about 67% of the dollar amount that was requested being approved. If you look only at the property tax side of that, it was $152 million out of a requested $230 million in property tax that was approved. The balance is the equalization aid piece. If we look at ballot questions, we had a total of 130 ballot questions, 76 of those who approved, about 58%. If we look at the districts that had at least one ballot question approved, 67 of the 99 districts had at least one ballot question approved. The difference between the 99 districts and the 130 questions is obviously some districts had more than one question on the ballot. One of the things we found was that when a district asked more than one question, that the success rate was quite a bit higher on the first question than on the additional questions. And what we found was, of the follow-up questions, only 9 of 31 were approved, or 29% of the follow-up questions. We also found that that school districts that requested a CPI adjustment be added to their levy had a lower success rate than school districts that did not ask for a CPI adjustment. There was a change in the school referendum law a few years ago that allowed a school district to say, we want X amount per pupil this year plus an adjustment for inflation for future years. And of the school districts that put that on the ballot, 31 of 68 questions were approved, or 46%. Of the school districts that simply asked for a dollar amount per pupil, 45 of 62 of those were approved, or about 73%. So a little easier to get it passed if you're not asking for inflation on top of a fixed dollar amount per pupil. A lot of interest in school districts that had phase-outs of existing referendums. We had 30 school districts that had phase-outs of existing referendums. So in other words, if the election was not successful, they were going to get less money in PO8 than they got in PO7. And what we found was that only 2 of 30 districts that had phase-outs were not successful, and that was the St. Cloud and Howard Lake Waverly school districts that were unable to renew an existing referendum, which means they will get less revenue from the referendum next year than they got this year. We had 4 of the 30 districts that had some but not all of their ballot questions approved. For example, the Anoka School District had 2 of 4 or 2 of 3 approved. And we had 24 of the 30 districts that had all of their ballot questions approved. The main thing there was it was 2 of 30 that weren't able to renew an existing referendum. The next section down below shows the success rate by type of district. We did not have Minneapolis or St. Paul go out this year. 54% of the suburban metropolitan districts were successful, 17 of 31 questions. The lowest success rate was in the larger greater Minnesota districts, those that had more than 2,000 students. Only 10 of 30 were successful, or 33%. The highest success rate was in the very small districts that have fewer than 500 students, and in that situation, 17 of 19 were successful for a success rate of 89%. This is the percentage of ballot questions here. And the bottom section here is, again, comparing just the referendum piece with end of session estimates. We projected about a $185 million increase in referendums as a result of elections. The actual figure was about $166 million, so we overestimated by about $19 million in total, and on the property tax side of that, it was the $14 million that I had referred to earlier. If you turn to the next page, page 4, this is a historical analysis of school district referendums going over time. The upper left-hand corner, if you go down to 2009, you'll see that we now have 306 school districts with an operating referendum in place for Pay-08. Compared to 300 last year, so we have an even 90% of all school districts will have an operating referendum in place for taxes payable in 2008. Over on the right-hand side, of the, just reading straight across from there, you will see that the average referendum revenue per student for all of those districts that have a referendum has now increased from $796 up to $901 per student, so a little bit over $100 increase per student on the average for those school districts that do have a referendum. And the lower section, the lower left section, is showing you the history of the success rates for referendums. This is based on percentage of ballot questions. We had a 58.5% success rate this year in terms of percentage of ballot questions, 76 of 130. That was higher than last year, where we had 33 of 86 approved for 38%. But it was lower than the historical success rate in the odd year elections, which has averaged something close to about 70% of the ballot questions being approved. Everything I've talked about so far is operating referendum. We did have some capital projects. Page 5 is showing you actually the detail of the capital projects that were on the ballot on November 6th. And I like to break these down into three distinct categories. The top third of the page are the traditional bond referendums, and we had basically 11% of the traditional bond referendums that were on the ballot here were approved in terms of the dollars that were requested. $53 million out of $403 million that was out of $457 million that was sought. And of course, the big one there was the Elk River District, which asked for $132 million and was not successful. The middle section here is what we call capital project referendums. These are basically like an operating referendum levy. They're not a bond issue. They're additional money for school districts, typically for technology purposes. Quite often these are school districts going out 10 years to buy additional computers or other kinds of technology sorts of things. 48% of the dollars that were requested in this type of levy were approved, $79 million out of $165 million. The last category here toward the bottom is maximum effort or one-day bond-related issues, and 100% of those were approved, and basically these are kind of a unique animal where the school districts have either generated some surplus funds in their capital loan account, or they're levying a rate that's less than the maximum effort school tax rate in order to pay off their principal and interest. And basically what these are doing is allowing them to either not pay back the state or to get their required levy up to the maximum effort loan rate. So essentially it's not a tax increase. And so in that situation, it's not surprising that 100% of those were approved. And the very bottom of the page is just giving you a heads up that we do have a few more still on the ballot for December, and those could theoretically affect the taxes this year. Pages 6 through 8, I won't go through the details of, but this just gives you a listing of each of the individual school districts that did have questions on the ballot, how many dollars per student they were asking for, and whether they were successful or not, and the vote total.
Thank you. This is excellent information, and to get this all together since the election is quite impressive, so we appreciate that.
Thank you.
And so I think then we want to hear now from the assessors to tell us about what's happening with market values. Is that right?
Collection.
And then we'll just open the discussion to everything about 2008, what we're looking for property tax.
Before we, Madam Chair, before we bring the assessors up, Eric has a few general trends just to go over to start at the table.
Mr.
And then we'll bring up the assessors.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Willett, will you direct us to what we're looking at?
I'll be brief. It's back to the handout that that we talked about earlier. The last three pages are some charts.
Okay.
These are preliminary statewide assessment numbers for 2008. They're not final, but we think they're pretty close. And basically, the first chart shows the increase in taxable market value for homesteads versus all other types of property. And what you'll see is that homestead are projected to be up only 5.4% in value total statewide next year, which is significantly about half as much as they increased last year, and about 9 percentage points less than just a few years ago at the peak of the housing boom. All other property is up almost 13%, and if you'll notice, the phenomenon here is the last couple of years homestead increases have been less than other types of property. Which generally means that the marginal dollar is going to be falling more, the tax increase dollar is going to be falling more heavily on non-homestead property than homestead property, which is different than what we experienced from 2000 to 2006 when homesteads were increasing above the average increase. The second chart is the same chart, except we break the other types of property into three categories to highlight what's going on with some other types of property. Agricultural is the dark blue bar. Their increase projected next year is 11%, which is still very high, but it's a little bit lower than where they were peaking at last year after a six-year run-up of significant value increases. Commercial industrial property is the light blue bar, and what you see there again is holding steady at a 12% increase, which is still very high for commercial industrial. But the big increases are in the other category, and that's driven by non-homestead residential, that is a residential property that is not homesteaded. That's up 22% next year, which is still a little less than last year, but still very high. And cabins or seasonal recreational property, which is projected to be up 20% next year. So those two types of property the last 2 years have consistently been seeing very big increases. A lot of that is new construction. But we don't have the final data yet to be able to split new construction from inflationary value. That's really the last piece of data we need before we can actually do a property tax run as opposed to these summary charts. So hopefully within a couple weeks or so, we'll have all the pieces in place to turn this into a property tax model that, like what you're used to seeing during those legislative sessions. And then the final chart is just the effective tax rates by class rate showing a lot of things going on. With effective tax rates are basically your net tax divided by your market value, and these have been going down for all types of property consistently since 1996. Basically, that's a phenomenon of a couple of things. Property values have been going up faster than levies for the last 10 years, so every time the values go up more, the effective tax rate goes down. Secondly, class rate compression that the legislature and the governors have done since 1997 have really brought those lines closer together, and that's the other phenomenon you're seeing in this chart. And just one caveat, a reminder, when we're looking at effective tax rates is that market value increases don't necessarily equate to income increases, as we all well know. So even with market value, effective tax rate decreases, burdens as a percent of income aren't necessarily going down, as we all know. And one final note that I don't have hard numbers on, so it's not in the chart, but the early numbers indicate that it looks like limited market value, the amount of limited market value is going to start going down next year, and that's probably related to the fact that homesteads aren't increasing in value as quickly as they were, but we'll have a lot better data for you when we do our full limited market value report, which we'll get to you early next session, but that may also be good news in terms of getting the limited market, less limited market value in the system. So I guess with that, we'll move on to the assessors.
I think we'll do that because we've got four people on the list, and if we can just finish with the assessors, then we can talk about everything, and we'll ask everyone to be a part of this. Yeah. I think getting the whole picture is helpful because assessed values, I really think, are going to come into play in the minds of Minnesotans next year. Usually people come and wonder why their assessments are going up, and they might be at their board of review asking why they're going down. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and members of the committee, for allowing us to be here. My name is Steve Kuha. I'm the Cass County Assessor. There are four of us from our State Association Legislative Committee here to speak with you this morning. Tom Hauslog from Rock County, and I will cover some outstate or greater Minnesota issues. And we have Stephen Baker and Tom May from the metro area to give you more detail focused on metro. Because of the time element, I'll be as brief as possible and to the point. What we're looking at is values in the greater Minnesota, for sure, are not plummeting, despite some of the reports that we might read. We've seen a stability in the marketplace, and in as far as northern Minnesota, for sure, which I would speak to, the lake communities and rural acreages, the values are stabilizing. We're seeing pockets of uncertainty where there might be some dips in market values, and there are certainly other areas where there are some increases in values expected as well. The number of sales, the transactions, definitely down. In looking at some numbers for Cass County in particular, in 04 and 05, those were still pretty strong years in the marketplace. January through October of those years, we saw typically about 1,300 to 1,400 legitimate transactions from January through October. For 06, that number started to decline when we saw the market softening, and for 07, we're at 40% less in transactions than we saw during those more stable years of 04 and 05. We got about 800 transactions January through October, and that's about a 40% decrease in our more stable years. So certainly the number of transactions are down. Properties are remaining on the market longer before they do sell, but what we're seeing is when they sell, the prices are, you know, they're stable. They're holding their own. They aren't heading south in a rapid fashion. So that's just kind of a big picture view from northern Minnesota, where seasonal and hunting lands are our primary the marketplace. And I think I'd turn it over to Mr. Hauslog for comments regarding agricultural issues.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Hauslog, Land Records Director. I'm the County Assessor and County Recorder from Rock County. Rock County is located in the extreme southwest corner of Minnesota. We're bordered on the west by South Dakota and on the south by Iowa. I do have a handout here. I'll just briefly walk you through what's happening in the agricultural sector.
That'd be great. And Mr. Kuha, you didn't have a handout, right?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Okay. I think this is really helpful because to hear greater and ag and then metro, because they'll all be a little bit different. So we appreciate this. Okay. Is everyone, not quite everyone yet? Do you have? This sign doesn't have. Okay. Mr. Hauslog.
Okay. What I want to walk you through is just the commodity prices that the farmers are seeing out there for the current harvest and the last two harvest seasons. What you're looking at is the Rock County current or posted cash prices as of yesterday when I left. Corn was selling for cash price at $3.78 a bushel, and beans were at $9.87 a bushel. A year ago for the 2006 harvest, corn was at $3.15 a bushel at this time of the year, and beans were at $5.05. I also talked to a few farmers in terms of what are they selling for on contract. Now, they were selling future prices for their commodities. Corn was selling for $4.50, and beans $10.60. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. And then the, I also talked to some other farmers that were looking at selling their crops for, you know, 2-3 years down the road, and they're looking at selling beans for $12 to $14 per bushel. And then prices for the 2005 harvest, you can see corn is only $1.50 a bushel, beans were at $6. Now, to translate that, what was the market doing at that time? I apologize, I thought I had the values on there, but I don't. Back in 2005 harvest, our top land was selling for around $3,500 to $4,500 an acre. If you went to last year's crop season, at the harvest at this time, land was selling for $4,600 up to as high as $5,500 an acre. Currently, through the current harvest season, land is now increasing up from $5,600 up to $6,500 an acre. Mostly the sales and the number of sales are in fact increasing for the last 2 to 3 years. As you can see, the prices of farmland has been going up very sharply, and there's an extremely high demand for agricultural land. For whatever reason, you talk to any realtor or market person, and they've got lists of people that want to buy farmland. So as you can see, land 2 years ago selling for $3,500 to $4,500 an acre, now selling for as high as $5,600 to $6,500 an acre. These are sales from farmers to farmers for farm purposes.
Thank you for that. Appreciate that very much.
Madam Chair, I think we would now turn it over to Mr. May and Mr. Baker for some metro aspects.
That would be great. Thank you both, and welcome Mr. May and Mr. Baker. And then when we hear what you two have to tell us, we're done. As far as now having kind of the whole big property tax picture, and we're going to have questions on any and all. It looks like we've got some handouts. Mr. May, did you want to begin?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, Hennepin County Assessor, and Stephen Baker, the Ramsey County Assessor, is here with me, and we're going to kind of go back and forth a little bit on some of the metro issues because they sort of overlap, and we won't give you the same thing twice. But in our talk, we want to talk not only about what's happening in the market, but we want to touch a little bit on foreclosures because that's a big issue for us in the metro right now, and just talk a little bit about how that impacts us.
And if I may interrupt while we're getting all these things, I should tell people I did ask Mr. Michael to work with everybody today to give us, you know, some context of what's happening with the housing market. That's what we've heard in the last two testifiers, and again now with foreclosures, as this is playing out across the state. This committee, of course, doesn't deal with that per se, but it's certainly going to affect property taxes and everything going on in the system. So that's why we're doing a little bit of this as it relates to market value. Mr. May,
thank
if there's something you want us to look at while you're talking, I think we've all got it now. So.
Right.
So you can direct us to page.
Just to start with a few statistics, if you look at the regional MLS, which covers the 13-county metro area and provides statistics on a monthly basis, just to show you a little bit about what's happening with the numbers in the market, in 2005, we had 24,000 or so active listings. Today, we have 34,000, so the active listings are up dramatically. The homes per buyer, or the homes available in the market for every buyer who's out there looking for one, in 2005 was about 5.5. It's now just about 11. So a dramatic difference in the market. Original list price compared to the sale price, or the sale price compared to list price, was about 97.8% in 2005. It's now 94.2, looking at 2007 numbers. If we look at median sale prices, and I would caution that these are sometimes a little bit squishy because they're not only single-family residences, they include condos and townhouses and the whole spectrum of sales, and also they really rely on whether the sample you're looking at in the previous year is really completely representative of the sample in this year. The median sale price for the area from last year to this year is down about 2%. The average sale price is down about 0.6%. So certainly there's some stresses on the market, but as we look at a lot of the numbers and you read some of the articles, sale prices aren't dropping dramatically, except whenever I say that and whenever I give you a statistic moving forward, there's going to be an exception to that. So I'll try to point out the exceptions as we move along. Again, just to remind you that the assessors look at the market value and the sales that occurred from October to October preceding the assessment. So for the 2008 assessment, we're looking at sales that occurred from October 1st, 2006 through September 30th of 2007. Of course, in today's market, we're also taking a much closer look at sales after that date and listings after that date to make sure we can predict where the market's going. But as far as what we're tested on or what we're, our performance is based on, it's still going to be that 12-month statistical timeline that I laid out. In Hennepin County, just quickly, single-family sales, and we talked about sales being down. In 2006, we had about 7,800 single-family home sales, not condos or townhouses, but single families. This year, we're estimating we're going to be at about 6,500 or so when all the sales are in. That's down between 15 and 20%. As soon as I say that, we do have some cities who have as many sales as they had last year, and we have some that have sales numbers that are down 40%. So it's a mix. Our residential, and as I go through, if I mention Minneapolis statistics, those will be numbers that the Minneapolis assessor, Patrick Todd, provided to me, so that just so you know that that's what he's seeing in the market also. Our residential basically is flat. We watch our ratios every month, and for the last 6 months, that ratio has been about the same, or just slightly up, which would mean just a little bit of a decrease. But most of our cities, most of our homes are going to have similar values to last year, probably the same. But as soon as I say that, the areas that we have that have a larger amount of foreclosures and are pressured by that part of the market, meaningly North Minneapolis, Brooklyn Center, some parts of Brooklyn Park, you're going to see decreases significantly larger than what we're talking about for the rest of the population. On the market, there are some upsides. Some of our lake areas, that market is still doing well. Some of our upper bracket homes, that market's doing well. In Minneapolis, some of the southwest areas, the lakes areas, and Kenwood type areas, that market's still doing well, and so there might be some upward increases in those areas. Condos is another issue. Everybody's heard about the condo market and how the number of condos that are available there, the number of projects that have been pulled because the market's just not there. We look at that market complex by complex, and it varies drastically. We'll have some complexes that are fine, and market values probably won't change, but overall we're going to be bringing condo values down some, and in some instances it could be greater than 20% in some of the complexes. So complex by complex, that'll make the difference. Our townhomes are higher than we'd like them to be, but again, it's complex by complex, so some will be coming down, some will be staying fairly much the same. With that, I'll let Stephen talk about the residential and Ramsey.
Welcome, Mr. Baker.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. As Tom mentioned, I'm Stephen Baker, Ramsey County Assessor. I would mirror Tom towards that. You know, the data is not only is it inconsistent, and the market really isn't all the same, but it's also early in our data season right now. Our sale file is just getting firmed up now, and we're still going through cleanup and things like that, so the analysis will change. But in Ramsey County right now, the kind of the rough numbers would seem to suggest that in the city of St. Paul, values have declined overall about 1.4%. And that's on the front of the handout that has the Ramsey County logo on it. Suburban values are down about 0.9%, and countywide, then that gives us about a 1.2% decline in market value. The sales have been mixed. We do have about 10% of our 130 single family, I think I've got residential neighborhoods in the report, that those are single family neighborhoods. About 10% of those neighborhoods would suggest that the values are off by more than 5%. The worst in that group, I think, was 17%. But we also have seven neighborhoods with value increases of more than 5%. So it's, as Tom mentioned, it's a little bit mixed, and we'll continue to monitor. We're going to talk a little bit about foreclosures. One of the things we're trying to identify early on is which neighborhoods have the potential to be most impacted by foreclosures going forward, and to try to make sure that we look at the sales data that we have appropriately and try to project forward what the sale prices are likely to be. As Tom mentioned, our sale file is from October to through September, but our valuation date is January 2nd of the coming year. So there's a little bit of a potential disconnect there if the market is changing during this period. And time is always one of the hardest things we have to adjust for in our process. The direction of the market now gives us some concern, but I would say that overall, I think there's a lot more fear out there right now than the actual sale prices would warrant in most areas.
Thank you for that. And that's reassuring, by the way, because I'm surprised to hear your report isn't as bad as I expected. So
a lot of the data that we hear is national. Mm-hmm. You know, and real estate is all local. I mean, as politicians, I say all politics are local. Real estate is all local too. So I think that you have to really take the overall national numbers in the newspaper with a grain of salt.
Okay.
So if you're moving on to the other types of property, I just want to briefly cover our multifamily and our commercial markets to give you a little idea of where they may be heading. Multifamily, I think everything. We have, whether it's a double bungalow or triplex up to a fourplex, those properties ran up in value very significantly over the last 4 years, and those are probably too high now. They'll be coming down. The market's kind of reacting to that, and those values will be coming down. Otherwise, apartments of our average style, average size, those are going to be very flat for 2008, and the dynamics of those is that rents are probably inching up a little bit, occupancies are doing a little better. But on the other side, the expenses are up and the cost of money is up a little bit, so our cap rates are moving up. We think it's going to be flat. The only part of multifamily that we'll see some increases in are the investment grade, larger deluxe type apartments that will probably be moving up in value. On the commercial and industrial side, the market for 2008 is fairly flat in most of our areas of commercial. But there's several areas that we look at as the areas where the values will be going up. They're kind of the hot areas this year. Those areas, as we see them, are small industrial and industrial flex buildings. They're doing well in the market, and the values probably going up. And when I say that, I'm not saying everyone, but generally in that range. Hotels, we've had some hotel sales, and they seem to be an investment choice now in the market, so those are going up. Our large Class A office buildings, including the Central Business District of downtown Minneapolis, those office buildings, those values will have upside. And retail that's in good locations is really doing well, and we'll see increases in value there. So overall, it's kind of a snapshot of what we see.
Thank you.
And I guess I would, you know, say that we've got a similar experience on apartments. We took our fourplex, fiveplex units down last year some. I'm not expecting we're going to have to reduce those significantly this year, though the market is still soft. But other than that, the apartment market seems to be holding pretty well. The large, more institutional buildings, I think, were likely to be increasing this year. In general, commercial investment-type real estate, apartments or commercial, straight commercial property, seems to still be holding its own as a vehicle of choice for investors. And there's good demand for it out there, and there's still not as much product on the market. Certainly, it's a much different supply-demand issue than on the residential side. On the commercial industrial markets, we're seeing a need this year probably to have increases in the city of perhaps around 7%, suburban approaching 10%, and countywide that would be about a 9% increase in our commercial values. Those value changes will mostly be centered in the office warehouse, industrial flex type properties Tom mentioned, and office property, land, and also any large commercial property. I would say maybe properties worth over $1 million. We're seeing strong prices. And I don't know how much of that I can attribute directly to market change this year, or whether or not we just had missed the market a little bit in the past year and are just now finally getting enough data to show us where the market truly is, and we undershot it in the past. So I always caution, sometimes change in assessed value incorporates both change in the level of assessment on a given type of property as well as market change in a specific year. The suburbs are doing well. The one number I guess I talked to a little bit is Roseville with the ratio at 103. We had a significant increase in Roseville's values last year, and it looks like we just overshot a little bit. I wouldn't say that's an indication that that market is weak. To the contrary, I think we had a 20%+ increase in Roseville commercial property last year. So it had been about 3 or 4 years since we'd done a complete review in Roseville, and the market, we just slipped a little bit behind as the market changed. So we're actually seeing good values there.
Madam Chair, if I could take just a couple minutes to touch on foreclosures.
Yes.
We think they're important. One thing foreclosures do is make it difficult for assessors because there's a wide range of foreclosures. It's not a one-size-fits-all when you start talking about these mortgage foreclosures. In Hennepin, we have anywhere from a boarded building with all the mechanical tore out to a group of brand-new homes in Broken Park in the $400,000 to $600,000 range. Same builder, 35 properties, and 27 of them are in foreclosure. So a wide range of what we're looking at. I would say that in the areas that are predominantly burdened with the high number of the foreclosures, the assessors are making an effort to get out and take a look at these when they notice them on the foreclosure list, because the condition of these is so important to really dealing with them in the upcoming assessment. I would also add that our association sales ratio committee is going to be working with the Department of Revenue to outline exactly how we handle, how we look at, how we identify these foreclosures as far as the standard foreclosures, whether there's fraud involved. It's a big issue. If you read that in the paper, there's a lot of fraudulent issues with some of them. The short sales where the mortgage company may agree to take a lesser sale than the mortgage to move the property, and then auction sales. So we're going to be dealing with that. The last thing I wanted to mention on foreclosures is a little snapshot of Hennepin County. I did pass out our Hennepin County Foreclosure Task Force document. Our county board established that task force to look at the foreclosure issue, and they really wanted to do two things. First, define the scope of the issue, and for your information, in 2004 we had 1,197 foreclosures in Hennepin County. In 2005 we had 1,693. In 2006 we had 3,055, and this year our best estimate is that we'll probably hit the 5,500 to 6,000 range in the county. So it's a moving, growing problem. The other thing they wanted to accomplish in the task force report was to identify appropriate responses. In other words, what can be done, you know, looking forward to help this out. And there's three areas as you look through the report that you see identified. One is targeting individuals or otherwise dealing with the homeowners, and in many cases the renters. I think many people would be surprised they knew that of those foreclosures in Hennepin this year, 40% of them are not non-owner occupied. And if you look at Minneapolis, the number is close to 60% are rental, non-owner occupied. So The issue really gets down to the impact also on the renters, the people that are displaced by the issue. There's also an area on ideas for neighborhoods and communities, and also an area targeting financial entities and trying to come up with some ideas about that.
You know, I guess foreclosures is a big issue and an important issue in Ramsey County as well. We've been having a series of meetings with the city of St. Paul. Is quite concerned about it, looking at if there's any harbingers or advanced signals we can get for future foreclosures, whether they be vacant houses, late water bills, that sort of thing. Just trying to get our arms around where is the foreclosure problem likely to be concentrated, and from our standpoint affecting real estate value, and then what additional value added can we bring to the conversation to help the cities address the issue proactively. In terms of assessment practices, we're currently investigating as many of the foreclosures as we can. By foreclosure, I guess there's a couple different sales we talked about. There's the sheriff sale, which isn't really a sale, that we don't use that. But then there's the REO sale by the bank, which typically is about a year after the foreclosure, maybe 9 months after the foreclosure. That sale can have some value for us to determine where the market's headed. But as Tom mentioned, many of them have significant problems that make it difficult to attribute that information or onto other properties. So we're looking at all those to see which ones we might want to include in our local analysis of the market. So if it's even if it's an REO sale that we would normally exclude, it won't be included in the state sales ratio study, but we can include it in our own internal analysis of where we think the market is to help us weight towards those effects where we see them taking place. Also, we're removing all the sales from our internal study, the sales that have taken place in the last year to 2 years that we would typically use to analyze the market if they've been foreclosed upon, just under the premise that if a buyer lost the property this quickly, there's likely something wrong with that original sale, so we're no longer going to consider it as part of our market data. And, you know, I think foreclosure mortgage reform is still needed. The companies, this is really largely a manufactured, an industry manufactured problem. And I did hand out the, you're probably wondering why I handed this out on the reverse mortgages. I was at a meeting, this was an article from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. We were meeting with some mortgage officials last week where one of the participants mentioned that they thought the next big growth area for predatory lending and mortgage fraud would be in the reverse mortgage area. And so now here a week later we see Ginnie Mae trying to provide liquidity to that market. We know with our financial institutions, the more liquidity you have, the more activity you have. So I think that this will be an area that will likely be something we'll be seeing in the future. And we'll, instead of, but it'll be a different demographic group that will typically be suffering. And the reverse mortgage is going to be our elderly and our retired rather than our young and our, you know, less well-off. As Tom mentioned earlier, this might be our most well-off group that's going to be potentially preyed upon next time around. So, and then lastly, we just had a couple pages on mortgages, the mortgage foreclosures in Ramsey County. And the last page is a chart that shows foreclosures by planning district in the city of St. Paul and then by suburban municipality. So if anybody's interested in any of those areas. And if you have any questions.
Thank you. And Mr. May, you
have I have one thing. Not to leave Greater Minnesota out of the foreclosure issue, there is a good report that was prepared by the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and Housing Link in July of 2007. It gives a lot of good information on foreclosures across the state.
Okay. Thank you for that. And so now we have covered, starting with the statewide summary, which the very first sentence was a projected 8.1% increase in property taxes statewide. We've covered the statewide, both greater and metro, and then the county, city, school, assessed values, foreclosures, and ag issues. And so we have lots to take questions on. We've got a list here, and first on the list is Justin Marker.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I have to say, Madam Chair, I'm still out there door knocking, and I wasn't out there Thursday because I was down here watching the volleyball tournament, and I have to say that Gilworth, Glenn, and Felton in AA knocked off the number one team and defending champs last night. So in five sets, very exciting match, so we're fired up about that, but I was in Detroit Lakes about 3 weekends ago, and a senior citizen by the name of Gene answered the door and began talking about her concerns and so forth, and her husband passed away at the age of 71 last December, and she said, "Paul, I'm concerned about staying in my house." And I said, "Why?" "Because of the high property taxes, and the property taxes going up." And she said, "You know, I want to stay in my home. I raised all 9 of my children here, and I didn't really work outside, so I don't have a lot of means for support and so forth, but she wants to remain there." And so I think a lot of us are hearing that over and over again, and so I don't think any of these numbers that we saw with the $549 million increase is any surprise. I mean, in fact, the numbers we were using last session were maybe $20 or $30 million higher than that, and that was it. So none of this is a surprise to anyone. And, you know, when you add all of that up now, we're going to be up to about $7.35 billion of property tax increases, which is an increase of another $550 million. And if you look at since 2002, that's an over $2.7 billion increase, about 60%. Now, adding on to 08 in those 6 years. And homeowners, it's going up about 70%, and ag land, it's going up about 40%. And up in my office now, there's a little chart that says, well, it's actually, it's a large chart. But Madam Chair, it says that we've now gone about 1,774 days without property tax relief since the 2002 plan. Property taxes have gone up every single year. That's about $1,000 per minute. Property taxes have gone up since 2002. So we've got a huge problem on our hands. And, you know, this year, well, and then what I thought was really interesting is school property taxes are now up over the $2 billion mark in these stats we saw today. And that is higher than what school property taxes were in 2001 prior to the 2001 tax reform. We have increased everything we cut with the state takeover, and now we're adding more with no end in sight. This year, the Property Tax Committee, the Tax Committee, and the House all passed significant property tax relief. It was about $440 million. Of property tax relief, and instead of seeing these numbers that are showing $548 million increase, and I think on homeowners, well, where's the increase on homeowners, but an increase on homeowners, that plan that was passed would have actually cut homeowners' property taxes from 07 by $120 million. Not an increase, but an actual cut of $120 million. And for ag land, it would have been a cut of about $7 million, and for small businesses, actually a cut. So, you know, I think this could have been prevented, but we're here where we're here today. And so I was wondering, would is Commissioner Ines still here?
Yes.
Would he be willing to answer a few questions?
I saw you get rid of your gum, by the way, Mr. Ryan.
Okay, come on, taught me well.
Yes, he did.
I thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Ryan, I first of all want to thank you. As you were talking about the Minnesota Property Tax Refund Program and some of the things that I know were out at the fair and so forth and some of your other efforts, and even though we didn't have a tax bill, part of that tax bill was to instruct the commissioner to look at ways to advertise these programs. And you have taken the initiative to do that even without a tax bill. So I really do appreciate that. And members, this summer as I was going through some old stuff, I found out a fact about Commissioner Ines. And that is, he was a very, very good tennis player, if you didn't know. The Northwest Tennis Association had this rankings, and it was from the mid-80s, and he was ranked very high in the open division, which is the highest division. So I guess he played college tennis, so... So I'm doing a lot of research. Just trying to find. I'm trying to think what I could play you at or whatever that I might. That tax bill over or whatever, win or lose, double or nothing.
Can we watch tennis? Play tennis and wrestle.
Well, we won't be tennis at any rate. But
just kidding,
Commissioner. I have some questions, and I don't know if you'd seen many of these numbers or have really had a chance to talk much, or the governor's had a chance to talk much about these, but as we go into 2008, as we start February 12th, are there any plans for a property tax relief proposal of any sort, or is that too early at this stage to talk about?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, at this point, you know, we've had discussions, the governor, myself, and my staff, discussions about what we should be doing on the property tax front, but most of the decisions regarding that will be made post-November forecast. And we're looking at a release date for November forecast of November 29th, just to find out what our resources are. We have put together a laundry list for the governor's staff about the different options that would be available, some of the same levers you pulled in the last session about beefing up the PTR, targeted property tax relief, supplemented with some LGA, but we've basically gotten to the point where we put a menu of options together for them. I think that the final discussions in determining how robust the package will have to come after the November forecast to determine what kind of resources we have and what we can promise.
Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. I had another question, and I think you alluded to that. I wanted generally, what were the governor's impressions and yours of that homestead credit state refund? And we put about $223 million into that, but just your comments on that approach and
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, there's no question if you were to ask the governor whether he preferred the Senate versus the House's approach to delivering property tax, there's no question he had much more affinity for the House approach. He thought it was much more directed at those individuals who actually need the relief, have high property taxes relative to the property tax burdens. I think the question became about how you were paying for it, and not necessarily the mechanism, but the manner in which you were paying for that property tax relief. But there's no question that that was the preferred approach. And I think when you guys came forward with your property tax division report, you guys clearly indicated you were serious about property tax relief with that package. No question about it. I can say we were disappointed in the final product that came out of conference committee. We thought it was too heavily leveraged with LGA, and there should have been more of a balance. A little more of a balanced approach, and we would have preferred putting more dollars in the PTR, maybe a little bit less in the LGA cost. But having said that, the reason the governor vetoed the bill, of course, had nothing to do with the property tax article. Other issues were in the bill that the governor had found not acceptable. And so he would have signed that property tax proposal that was in the final conference committee report. But having said that, we had a fairly lengthy meeting comparing the Senate approach versus your approach, Representative Marquardt, and he found a lot to like about your approach. He liked the supercharged PTR. That if we're going to be serious about property tax relief, let's get it to the individuals who are truly in need, rather than doing a blanket kind of buy down of all the levies for all classes of property that's targeted at individuals in need. So there was a lot to like about your proposal, and the governor was aware of your proposal.
Madam Chair,
Representative Marquardt.
There's been a lot of talk, and I hear kind of a couple sides of this, is whether or not the state has any impact on rising property taxes. I hear say that, no, it's totally up to a local decision, and, you know, nothing the state does really impacts. What is your view of that, or the governor's view of, does the state have a role in the level of property taxes that's levied by local units of government?
That's right. Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, yeah, there's no question that I think the state, or the governor believes the state has a legitimate role in mitigating property taxes. And that is manifest itself in the PTR. The governor showed a commitment to the PTR. He showed, maybe not a strong commitment as some people would like, but he's also shown a commitment to restoring some of the LGA. He understands there's a role for LGA. There are certain communities that don't have the local tax base in order to maybe deliver all the necessities. And so he's been an advocate of an LGA within reason. And so I think he thinks there's a role on the margins for the state to influence property tax decisions and help those individuals who truly need the assistance. But at the end of the day, it's primarily, other than the state general tax levy, it's a local revenue source. And it's hard to generalize about property taxes across the entire state. Every taxing jurisdiction has a unique fact pattern and a unique set of circumstances. So to make, you know, state policy at the state level that takes into account all those nuances and those, you know, distinct fact patterns is problematic. So I think the best we can do at the state level is target relief at those individuals who need it. Try to keep those individuals in their home, those ones that are under. But it's hard as a general rule to, you know, do macro politics at the state level that really has a large impact on property tax levies, unless you do something like a very hard freeze, hard levy limits, both kind of what I would characterize as effective, but it's a certain kind of blunt instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on the margins, the state has a very important role. But I think that at the end of the day, local units of government make decisions and their constituents make decisions. We encourage people to go to their truth and taxation hearings if they feel that the levies that are being proposed are too high. And I think it's worth mentioning that what we saw today, the data we saw today, is really a worst case scenario. There's still an opportunity for citizens to be heard, to go to the truth and taxation hearings, and try to reduce those levies if they think the local government is, you know, being irresponsible. So, long way of saying, it has a role. I think it's unreasonable to think that we're going to have, without a huge infusion of dollars, having a major impact on the property tax levy increase.
Madam Chair,
yes, sir, Mark.
Well, Commissioner Inez, I do appreciate that response, and that the state does have a role, because I do think local units of government at times think they're just being left out there, and the state doesn't realize that, and I'm just happy to hear those comments. Last area, over the summer and the fall, I've really been digging into that tax incidence study, but there's
three areas that I really am concerned about as I've looked at that is that since 2002, quite frankly, taxes have gone up from 11.3 as a percent of your income to 11.7 from 2002 to 2009 projected. That's one area of concern. Since 2002, the system has become more regressive. The suits index has from minus 0.018 to minus 0.033. Then the third area, which I think these increases in property taxes have had a lot to do with, is that from 2002 to the current, is that the local share of tax revenues, the local share has gone from 24.6 to 28.5. And I guess my question to you is, has there been any talk in the department as far as trying to reverse those trends? And what might be some strategies that would do that?
Mr. Ryan.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Mark Court. You know, I have to say, with all honesty, there hasn't been a lot of discussion regarding the tax incentive study. Undoubtedly a lot of discussion. What's driving the increase in regressivity? I think you touched on it very accurately. Those are kind of the main drivers of why we're trending slightly regressive. So we've had a lot of discussion about it. We have not had a lot of discussion about, you know, what would we do to reverse this trend. I think it's important to remember that, and we talked about this during legislative session, that it's exceedingly difficult for a state tax system to be, you know, progressive, a tax system. If you can get the proportionality, you're probably in the top tier of states that have done that. As you noted, we are slightly regressing, slightly trending, regressive, more regressive. You have a limited number of levers. I mean, we have a high progressive income tax, and the rest of the levers that we pull from the revenue side are all regressive taxes. Gas tax, sales tax, property tax, every other thing. And so I think we do a fairly good job across the spectrum of all taxes, almost getting to proportionality. We are concerned about trending too far, to being too regressive. But we don't have a silver bullet right now. We're going to advocate in order to try to reverse that trend. I would be concerned about, though, an answer to the incidence report by saying, "Well, we're just going to bump up the income tax and make, you know, just in order to level this out and make it proportional." I think there's other ways to address the issue if you're concerned about it. Going after an income tax reform would already have, a very progressive income tax would probably be a strategy that we would find problematic.
Madam Chair,
Representative Marker,
thank you very much. And I agree. I don't know if we could ever get a totally progressive system, but we're moving in the wrong direction, and we need to do something about that. And I do personally believe that a dramatic and significant decrease in property taxes would be one of those things that would hit all three of those areas. One of those things that would hit all three of those areas I just mentioned on being more regressive and more local, and even the amount of taxes. I think it would lower all of those and at least move them in the direction. And so, members, we don't come back till February 12th, but we need to hit the ground running, because property taxes are still hitting our families and our farmers and our senior citizens and small business terribly. And I think not only by continuing very hard on this property tax relief approach do you help those folks, but you also make the tax system fairer. And I do think those are the major goals of what we tried to do in the tax committee, and I think all members should be commended for that, is that we tried to lower property taxes and make the system fairer at the same time. And as I talk to folks out in my district, they like that. I mean, people are hurting with property taxes, and I think if any other tax was going up like this, without a rate increase, you'd be screaming. If this was income tax or sales tax on the same amounts and so forth, people would be screaming, and we would be doing a lot more than what we're doing. And I just think, as members here and as a state, we need to put this at a high, high priority. But Commissioner Idens, thank you so much for your comments, and Madam Chair, thanks for the time.
Thank you. And we have Representative Lanning, then Broad, then Earhart. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a number of questions along the way here, and I'm
trying to figure out maybe where to start, but maybe Mr. Ouellette, if he could join us back here. Thank you very much for that that good packet of information that you gave us. Can you tell me at what point we're going to be able to see some regional variations on this market value? I mean, this was overall statewide, and I find that very helpful. But my sense is that we're seeing a tremendous amount of variation. You know, the high point being the lake areas that are still experiencing very high increases in property values, and some of the more rural communities where property values, I think, are really declining. Can you give us some sense as to when we'll get more particulars in terms of regional variations here?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, we should be able to get that in very short order. So within 1 to 2 weeks, we can probably put that together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And then I had a question for assessors.
Yes, please.
I don't know.
Any and all join us. And Mr. Ouellette, you know, if you could make that information available to the entire full tax committee and the property tax committee members, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. Should I work with staff to determine what
sure.
regions should be?
Well, and I would work with Representative Lanning as well, but I think House Research and we'll have a good idea to, in general, what this committee likes to see, which is basically everything, but the more the better.
We'll do.
Thank you. And Mr. Kuha and Mr. Is it House Slot, you want to join us as well? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question related to the foreclosure and issue and how that is affecting sales ratio studies and how it's going to affect determining property values for neighborhoods. Obviously, if you can have a foreclosure that can happen in any neighborhood, even a high value neighborhood. But my concern is when you have a lot of foreclosures that are happening in particular neighborhoods or sectors of communities or communities. How are you trying to figure out just how that's going to impact market values in that neighborhood or community? Obviously, if you've got a lot of them in a neighborhood or a community, it has to raise serious questions about what the real value of the other housing is in that community or neighborhood. But could you say more about how you're trying to sort that out?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I think in foreclosures there's a couple issues, and I think you hit on them. It really depends on the amount of foreclosures you have in a certain area. In some cases, we have some condos where foreclosures become the market because they're so prevalent. In other words, nothing sells in there other than a foreclosure. But in most cases, if you look at the market, and we typically, like Stephen Baker said, exclude those foreclosures from our analysis. But when you get enough in an area, the sales of the market or the arm's length transactions are brought down because of the foreclosures in the area. And we're watching that very closely. And I believe that when I reference some of the areas where we're seeing market value decreases much higher than other areas, is being driven by the amount of foreclosures they have in those areas that I talked about. So it affects the market, and if we read the market right on the good sales, it should tell us what impact they're having.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you. The only other point, I guess, points I would make, I sure hope that property tax relief is high on our agenda as we look forward to the upcoming session. Back to the information that we had on the tax compliance issue, it struck me that the question was asked, I don't remember who asked it, about whether as we look at revenue forecasts, whether this is kind of a cumulative thing and you continue to count on that revenue. It seems to me that maybe you can only count on it to the extent that people didn't understand their obligations, and now they understand, so therefore going forward the revenue will continue to be there. But to the extent that the compliance is based on other factors, I don't know that you can count on that. And so I know that Commissioner Innes is, this is not his responsibility, but I would assume that we'll have Commissioner of Finance before us sometime after the forecast comes out. And I'd like to find out, are we really counting on that to be, you know, what we captured in previous years is going to continue to be captured, or are we really starting over with each biennium? And you know, I don't know what the answer to that is, but that's a question I think we ought to be pursuing.
Thank you for that. I agree, and we are going to have Commissioner Hansen in come in and talk to us after the forecast. The question will be, do we want to wait till the February forecast, since we're not going to be here till February 12th? I don't know when the February forecast comes out, but by then we'll be, whatever we hear in 3 weeks will seem old. So we do intend to hear from him, and I think we all agree, this committee, I think everybody's disappointed that there's no property tax relief on its way. So, Representative Broad.
Excellent, Madam Chair. Representative Lanning got to my question regarding the process for the neighborhoods around the foreclosure areas, especially in areas where there's heavy foreclosure activity. I'm trying to figure out how you recalibrate those neighborhoods, and at what point do you potentially go backward in terms of valuations, and what is the decision-making process from a assessor or a board standpoint in some of those areas that have been heavily hit by foreclosure activities. And I think in that sense, it's probably the higher value home foreclosure activities that I'm referring to.
Who would like to take that one? And Representative Broad knows a lot more about this than she's letting on in her question.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I think that we're always going to look at the good sales as long as we have sufficient numbers of arm's length sales. For the same reason I explained earlier, foreclosure sales so many times for assessors are very difficult because of the condition of many of these properties. It's not the condition that we assess them in. There's many times these properties have things happen to them in the process, and so we can look at those and adjust those individually if they're structurally deficient in some way, but that doesn't change our whole market. But in the areas where we're finding the heavy amount of foreclosures, those are the areas I talked about. We're already going to be going backwards on our market value because those foreclosures being in the market with all the regular sales have dragged the market down. As far as our higher price foreclosures, I think we were seeing pockets of dense foreclosures like the one I mentioned in Brooklyn Park. If you look at those, I think they're going to fall into that area of fraud, and there's something that happened in that process because the builder's the same and there's multiple owners and the same on several of the homes. It's kind of like I don't remember if in the paper it was New Prague or somewhere that had the new development that something similar happened. I'm not sure. Was that New Prague?
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's a little different thing because then you have to look back and say those original sales shouldn't have been in our study to start with. Mm-hmm. Just like Stephen was talking about, and we can take those out and then see what the market tells us.
I guess that really gets to my concern because when you look in a specific situation like that, for example, some of those homes actually sold for quite a bit above what they really belonged, what the valuation really was. And so if those homes were used at that point, values around them in the neighborhood were set based on some of those sales. And so some of these homeowners have been being taxed at a rate that was well above where it belonged in the first place. So I'm trying to figure out how you recalibrate overall in a situation like that. And I use that word because I think it's a technicality. I think it is a technical process, but you know, we're seeing a sense, and in a sense, these folks have been overtaxed based on those sales which were used, which were fraudulent sales, and so that's what I'm trying to get at. And I think you kind of got in that direction. And Madam Chair, I have to apologize. I've got 125 school kids waiting for me over at the Capitol. So okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Broad. And Representative Broad, many of you may or may not know, is very familiar with these issues and works in the area. And so I want to apologize that we have Hennepin and Ramsey, and she's, I think, Goodhue and Scott. And so we had some rural, but we really have not hit every sort of state situation here, and we're just trying to broad brush the whole state with the four of you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Manager. I'd like to ask the commissioner a question or two. But while I'm doing that, Mr. Michaels, do you have any idea of the amounts that are raised by the sales, the tax, the income, and the property? Those used to be fairly even. Is anybody... I thought maybe you had that on the back of your printer there somewhere.
Mr. Michael, percentage of income, sales, and property. He probably knows.
Oh, well, that's okay.
I don't have, Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I don't have, at the tip of my tongue, the exact. Now, I think actually, you know, for a long time, the property tax was the leading tax, and then, I don't know if you remember, Representative Dawkins cutting his hair. And the income tax surpassing the property tax, and now I think I don't remember what the exact forecast for the income tax is, but it's in the 7.3 billion range, and so property taxes are sort of creeping up, so they're going to be very close.
Okay.
For probably fiscal 08 or thereabouts. To what income taxes? I'm not exactly sure, but
okay, they're still in about the same.
I think
ratio?
Income taxes are still going to be the major, large, higher than property taxes, but this is a gap.
The leg length of the three-legged stool. That's
right.
Trying to figure out how even it's.
How we're doing?
Okay.
Madam Chair, I have one for the commissioner here, and I was thinking about articles that I read last year regarding the property taxes that are generated for transfer station uses, that was now more coming from property tax to support transportation than those from the normal sources of gas tax, tab fees, federal government, and so forth. So, do you have any idea how much of the property taxes are levied for transportation purposes statewide? I think that you should have that. I have gathered it from cities and so forth to make points. But do you ever talk about that? I mean, we've got an abnormal situation when a little old lady is being taxed. She doesn't drive a car to run the potholes and fix the potholes and the roads.
Ms. Reina.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I don't have that information at my fingertips, and I see our property tax people are conferring right now. So if we don't have it, I can see if it's accessible and just get back to it. But I think I saw the same op-ed piece in the Tribune where it talked about the growing piece of the pie that property taxes that goes for transportation purposes. So I will confer with them and see if we can get that information.
Well, actually, Madam Chair and Commissioner, that person has been rising rapidly in cities and counties because they're not getting any money for the normal sources, which would be the gas tax, for instance, or the highway user trust fund distribution. So I don't know if anybody cares about that over there, but whoever you talk to, I don't know who you confer with about such matters, but I think it would be nice to know, and they also be told, and somebody in your department should probably have a handle on what those dollars are. Thank you.
Mr. Reines, that would be helpful because I think Representative Earhart, we all know, has been one of the leading voices in getting this before Minnesotans to really think about it. Should we really be funding the transportation system on the property tax? And that's where we're heading. I mean, we're moving in that direction more every day. And I'm sure this committee will grapple with a transportation proposal with a series of tax changes, and it would be helpful to know that because it is part of the property tax now in a much bigger way than it has been historically, I believe.
And that, in fact, concurs. It's a good piece of information that's going to probably be needed in order to make an informed decision on how we're going to fund transportation going forward. It probably doesn't fall clear in the purview of this committee or the Department of Revenue, but it's an important piece of the equation.
Further questions? Now I have one final one for you, Commissioner Ines, since you're there. Representative Marquardt really was grilling you there for a little while, so he got me thinking.
Well, he kind of laid the foundation. Thanks for all the good work you've done on CPR and all that.
He's very polite.
Then he's asked you.
Yes. Very polite. But I do want to ask you, you know, you probably get the same question I get from everybody, which is, there's going to be a tax bill, you can bring back the old tax bill, you know, and we hear that. In my mind, you know, the tax bill I really care about is the first tax bill that was vetoed, not the second tax bill that was vetoed. Nonetheless, it's on the mind of members and groups that lobby this committee and Minnesotans. And we don't know what the forecast is going to hold, so it's premature. But, you know, can you give us a kind of a big picture approach to kind of what's the work agenda for the Department of Revenue for 08 as it relates to priority of a tax bill, priority of property tax relief. You know my personal concern, and, you know, I continue to be upset about where we're at with federal conformity. Big concern for me, and it's going to become a big issue for Minnesotans when they find out what's happening. Can you just tell me kind of where are you and the governor with the whole tax agenda for 08? What are you planning to, you know, work on to get ready for 08 between now and February? Because we're all thinking the same thing. You know, what do we all need to be dealing with between now and February?
Well, Madam Chair, I think the department, any administration, shares a lot of the same concerns you share. Federal conformity, I mean, it's a problem not only for the agency administering the tax, but more importantly for the taxpayers. If you've seen the draft we've done of the MNCR form, whatever, the non-conformity form, it is complicated. It is not conducive to voluntary compliance. It's not helpful for the taxpayer. So, you know, in an ideal world, we'd like to get that passed early on. You know, there's also got to remember that's a $25, $26 million item. And in light of the November forecast, we don't know what the resource situation is going to be, but that would be a high priority for the agency. Also, we will be out of conformance with streamlined sales tax as of January 1st of this year because of failure to pass that bill. That is an issue for us. We have been at the table from the very beginning with streamlined sales tax and a very active member. We have some, the business community in Minnesota is supportive of that effort. And so I think there's actually a meeting in Dallas, I believe, this month or next month. And we'll see if we can get a little grace period from the streamlined sales tax governing board. Not throw us off, you know, on January 1st. Maybe give us a little grace period to get back into conformity, and we'll be talking to you about that. But I think Representative Marquardt's point's the best. I think when the rubber hits the road, property taxes is going to be the number one issue we're going to talk about. You know, we spend more time probably legitimately talking about property taxes than all the other tax types combined. And so I think that will that'll be front and center once again. And hopefully we'll have some resources to utilize for that. But all these decisions, as you know, Madam Chair, are going to be made after the, you know, after we find out exactly what the budget situation is. And I got a feeling I'll go back to that, the tax bill that you put on the governor's desk, and there's lots of likes in that tax bill. I mean, 90% of that tax bill was a consensus tax bill. So hopefully we can go back, tweak a few of the provisions that were problematic, and if we have the resources and we have a way to pay for it, we can do some of those things. But I know that's probably going to be, I think, the meat of it. There's some short-term things that the agency is really, you know, concerned about, in federal conformity streamline. But the big one, I'm sure it's going to be property taxes. I found out this week it's fluid. You never know what's going to happen. We got curveball thrown to us this week with that 8th Circuit Court of Appeals coming up with a decision, which, you know, it's a decision that has, if we're not successful on appeal, has substantial revenue implications.
And I apologize because we were going to go through that, and I think what I'll ask is if you can provide, or I'll ask Mr. Michael to provide information to the full committee on the whole railroad issue, because that is a concern. And
so issues like that come up, just like the way those things are, issues that come up that we didn't forecast or didn't anticipate, that your committee, the budget, and our attached to take into account. And so you just talk to me in 2 weeks, and I may have a different set of issues. that'll be taking up our time and energy. But I think those issues, ones you touched on, and in property taxes, are going to be where the governor's going to spend most of the time and energy.
Okay. Thank you for that. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.